is it is, three separate you have to buttons?
Set, you have to set the tracks you record to.
Oh.
Yeah. Okay. Which we've done now successfully, and we are live. And this is Dude That's Dope, episode 5. I'm here. I'm Alex Van Dyne. I'm here with my boy.
What's up? I'm Gregory Thaler. And we have the lovely, the fantastic Chef Liz with us today.
Hey, how's it going, guys?
It's going good. You're here.
It's good.
Yeah. We just ate a bunch of really good food.
Yeah,
thanks
we
to
did.
You.
It's pretty good.
And it's great to have you here. And just maybe we should start a little bit of background, Liz. What do you do in terms of food? What's your history with food?
So my background in cooking started, I mean, honestly, it started when I was like, I would say 12. I've always had a passion for food. I grew up in Berkeley, California, which is very well known for their food and for the restaurant industry. It is where Chez Panisse's and Alice Waters started Chez Panisse, and she really kind of led the food revolution, I guess a lot of people call it, in opening up the doors for female chefs, opening up the doors for sustainable eating.
Cool. She sounds dope. I don't know her, but she sounds great.
She's an awesome woman, and she actually lives like right down the street from where I grew up.
Wow.
And I've eaten at her restaurant several times. She also is one of the creators of Acme Bread in the Bay Area, which my...
Acme?
Acme Bread,
that's
yes.
That's hilarious. She named it Acme? That's like a Roadrunner.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
And actually, the original Acme Bread is right down the street from my parents' house, where they still live, where I grew up. And I also grew up right down the street from this awesome market called Monterey Market, which is basically like a permanent farmer's market. They only sell local produce. It's all seasonal. And it really was quite awesome growing up in this area. Because,
yeah, you got lucky.
Yeah, I got really lucky.
Like in the right place for this.
Neither of my parents are amazing cooks. Like they have their certain dishes that they, you know, they made growing up that were really good. But overall, you know, growing up, the food that they made was not super interesting.
Well, where are your
or
parents from?
My parents are from the South, actually.
So that's, you know, interesting to think about. I think access to good resources probably changes your
outlook on food.
Outlook on
exactly.
Food.
I mean, my mom, my mom grew up in the 50s, and her mother was German. And so they really didn't eat super interesting food growing up. And so I think that kind of translated to the food that I grew up eating is that nothing was like not a lot of super interesting different ingredients. But, you know, we always had salads. Like my parents always tried to encourage eating vegetables. That was one big thing that they did always try and encourage.
Yeah.
And that was very beneficial living in the city of Berkeley because we had access to that. And I got really into food when I was in high school because I got interested in baking and I pretty much just wanted to learn whatever I could. I would sit and watch Food Network all the time. And
do you have a favorite show on Food Network?
I don't watch it too much anymore, but when I was younger, I really loved, I loved Dina Garden.
Ina Garden. Okay.
Yeah. So she actually is in her like whole show is about she lives in the Hamptons and she.
Okay.
Yeah. It's really like kind of bougie and like
real sad lifestyle.
But
so tough out here in the Hamptons,
just scrounging.
But one of the reasons why I did love watching her was because she always went to local market. She tried to, you know, like in her show, she would actually be physically going to these local markets, to the farmers markets, getting products from friends that she knew.
Yeah.
And that's something that really inspired me. And especially being from a place like Berkeley, where I had such easy access to get local seasonal ingredients, I really was inspired by her cooking. And her cooking was also very simple most of the time.
Yeah.
And that's something that a lot of people don't understand, that these days. I think they think that all chefs, it has to be this whole complicated, complex thing of like the modernist cuisine and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, they're filling pillows with smoke.
But good food doesn't have to be complicated.
Right.
If you're using good ingredients and you're starting off with good ingredients, good food is really simple, to be honest. And a lot of the times when you go to a restaurant and you think that something's super complicated, it's actually a lot easier than you think it is.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, that's also for design and in like parallels with that in the same way. You know what I mean? Good design is like often super simple. The best design is generally something that's been designed to be simple, you know?
Yeah.
Like, you know, if you're doing some sort of UI paneling and there's buttons everywhere, that's not good design. You know what I mean? But if there's a segmented amount of buttons that really draws attention to exactly what you need, then you understand that this is like easy to use and there's like a setup for, you know, it's natural for you to be able to look at things and understand where to go to find other things, you know, and that's good design is like, it's thought out and simplified
to talk point. Yeah. I mean, I think you're totally right. I think you're both right. I think what I've noticed is about like reduction too sometimes, right? You know, it's very easy to kind of keep adding to something and it starts to get out of hand.
Well, that's a crutch too.
Like if you think about like, you know, in the case of food or design, with food especially, you're saying like a lot of chefs probably they're just overthinking it, getting too complicated, adding too many layers to something.
Yeah, and the thing is not to say that molecular gastronomy and all and creating those complex flavors is a bad thing. I mean, I've eaten at some amazing, super innovative restaurants. I mean, here in Los Angeles, there's Bazaar.
Yeah.
And they have an incredible menu where, I mean, it's massive as well. And they actually have broken it down to where it's all tapas style. And they have one section where it's traditional tapas, more simple, using more focused on the ingredients. And then they have the modernist section where they're using more innovative, different techniques to create things like, I had this one dish there the last time I ate there where it was an olive, but it was an olive encapsulated in this, like in a little spoon basically. And you ate it and it burst into your mouth and it tasted exactly like an olive, but it was not an olive. And stuff like that is awesome and super cool. And I do own The Modernist Cuisine, which is a great, great, great book. I got it when it first came out. My dad actually pre-ordered it. Like it was a gift for my 21st birthday. And it's an amazing book. It comes with its own bookshelf. It's incredible.
Wow.
And going through it is amazing, looking at all these different innovative ways to use traditional techniques, but in a modernist way. And it is very, very intriguing. And I'm not saying that that is not a very, very important aspect of cooking. It is.
Yeah.
But for me, I have always loved the simplicity of cooking. And that's something that I've been really trying to center my blog around, is the fact that cooking is simple, and if you focus on using good ingredients and understanding your ingredients and understanding how to use them, then you can create something really awesome, because cooking doesn't have to be complicated and you shouldn't be scared to cook at home. I think so many people this age are afraid to cook because they get so used to the Postmates, Uber Eats, and the fact that it's so easy to get good food from a restaurant just delivered to you.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
I mean, our world has definitely become so streamlined and simplified that it's like easy to ignore a lot of like basic things that you would do on your own.
Yeah. Well, it's also it's like, you just gave me a crazy idea. It's like when people are cooking dinner, so often people live alone in cities.
Yeah.
Yes.
You know, and when you're cooking dinner alone in a city, it's kind of like,
It can be a bummer.
It's kind of a bummer. Yeah, it's kind of sad, you know?
Yeah.
And I was thinking, like, man, what if they had, like, an app where, like, you could cook dinner with your neighbors, you know?
That's a cool idea.
Like, if somebody wants to cook dinner, they can do it for their neighbors, and then they get, like, money or something for it through the app.
But the whole thing is that I've always liked to tell people is, why not, if you're just cooking for yourself, make it special?
Yeah.
What's wrong with that? There's nothing wrong with that, in my opinion.
I don't think so.
Like... I mean, I have had so many friends where I love whenever I, even when I cook for myself, like I'll take the time to make my plate of food look really nice because for me, I feel like that's, it makes it more exciting.
Yeah.
And there should be no reason why you can't do that.
Yeah.
I mean, you need to make, cooking is supposed to be fun. It's supposed to be playful. You're supposed to be trying new things. And if you're just making the same thing over and over and over again, of course it's going to be boring.
Yeah.
And you're going to get sick of it. Yeah. So why not try something that you've never done before?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I think this is like our culture is so used to the immediacy of gratification as far as like whatever effort you expend, you expect the reward to be way more immediate than it used to be. Like, you know, back, I feel like in the day,
Well, I also think, like, part of it, too, is that back in the day, cooking was a survival thing.
Right,
you know? Exactly. And so learning techniques and learning all these things was so that you didn't have to keep eating the same thing every day.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Now we've gotten to this point where if you want to learn to cook, and I don't think this is a good thing. I personally love cooking. Like, my mom is, like, instilled in me a love of cooking and, you know, taught me techniques. But I think where people get tripped up is probably that they need to know the techniques. They need to learn how to do it, you know? And you got to take the time to do that. And that's partially what I think Liz is trying to do, right?
So back to kind of like how I got into cooking, throughout high school, I did work in a couple different food service areas, primarily in the front of house. I worked at a bakery. My first job was at a bakery down the street from my parents' house where I grew up. And I started working right at 15. My parents were very, you know, adamant about me either doing a sport or if I wasn't doing a sport, I needed to get a job.
Yeah. Right.
And okay. So sport when I decided to stop rowing, I rowed in high school.
Epic.
And when I decided to stop rowing, they said, okay, it's time for you to get a job then.
Yeah.
So obviously I wanted to get a job at this bakery because I grew up going there. I mean, I got birthday cakes there growing up. We knew the owners and pretty much right away, like they were like, yeah, of course we'll give you a job. And I worked there for a long time, actually. I worked there for 3 years.
Wow.
And
that is a long time. Yeah. Yeah.
And, especially for high school. Yeah. And, you know, I stopped working there, my senior year of high school. And then from there, I ended up going to a cafe, worked there for throughout a couple of months, up until I decided to go to college. And when, college came about, you know, a lot of people pretty much assumed that I was going to go to culinary school. And I did look into it. I looked into Culinary Institute of America, and I did get accepted to actually both locations. They have two locations here in the U.S. They have one in New York, and then they have one in here in California, in Napa Valley. And I got accepted to both programs.
Wow.
But I decided not to go.
Why?
Because it's about the same cost as going to an Ivy League school.
Oh, yeah. Okay. For sure. Okay. Well,
and
the cost.
And it's also one of those things where it's never a guarantee that, I mean, like college as well, it's never a guarantee that you are going to get a job right out of there.
Yeah.
And I figured that it was going to be more beneficial for me to go and major in hospitality management.
Yeah.
Learn the management side of the restaurant, because really my goal was that I wanted to own my own restaurant. I loved cooking and I loved the aspects of cooking, but my goal was to open up my own restaurant. Yeah. So I figured that it was a smarter move to go to college and study how to manage a restaurant.
Yeah.
So I got accepted to Cal Poly Pomona. It was actually the first college that I went and visited.
Yeah.
And it took me a while to make the decision. I was looking at a lot of other places. But the reason why I decided to go with there is it was in California, and I knew that if I went there, I wasn't going to be bogged down by, student loans.
Yeah. Which is, that's a real thing. I mean, I, you know, it's funny. I feel like my parents told me, or it was understood that if you went to college, you were getting a job, you know?
That's the funny thing
about
college.
That has changed.
It's changed so much, dude. Yeah. And that also brings me, you were saying this stuff about being in, like, not wanting to go into the culinary school, and then you were talking about how you wanted to open your own restaurant, and now, like, after having talked to you and talked to your, like, about your experiences working as a chef and a sous chef at different restaurants, I'm just like, man, it is not fucking worth it. And it's, like, almost soul-crushing to, like, hear that.
The profit
and the payout for dedicating, because that's a grueling fucking job to be there all day on your feet, like back and forth managing a kitchen. That is a hard fucking job. It's super stressful. And the payout, the reward for that is like so minimal, and it's super, super hard to make the reward.
Well, even, you know, I think it's worth it at all. It'll burn you out for sure, I bet. I mean, I'm not, I only worked in the service industry for, you know, maybe a summer, you know? And it, like, my first job, I was basically a busboy at a cafe, and I was like, fuck this shit, I never want to work in this again. Because that sucked, and, you know, I don't know, I didn't want to go down that route. But I think, you know, the whole industry, the service industry, it's very taxing and should be rewarding. I think you're right. It's like not as rewarding as it should be, you know?
Well, it's not just the service industry though, right? Like it seems to be the whole restaurant industry, not so much service. Cause I mean like Banana Republic is technically like service industry, right? But like the restaurant, they make a ton of money, but the restaurant industry like seems to not be making very much money.
Is there a union?
There is actually not.
It almost seems like there should be.
There needs to be a chef's union.
I mean,
she could use it.
It's very unfortunate. I mean, I can't tell you how many people who have had work for me that went to Cordon Bleu, which now does not exist, and for good reason, because they actually tell you, oh, you're going to get a sous chef or a chef job right out of graduating from here. And it's like, no, you're not. Are you kidding me? Absolutely not. You know, I have actually had chefs tell me before that they do not hire people who went to culinary school. They see that somebody went to culinary school and that they don't have that much work experience, and they go, nope, not interested. I am not going to hire you. It is because they teach them that they basically elevate your ego. From what I have heard is that they elevate your ego, and they make, and really what it comes down to it is every single chef, every single restaurant has a different way of doing things because they learned it in a different way.
Right.
I have seen how to make stock, fucking stock, chicken stock, probably five different ways.
Because it all depends. What's the best way to make chicken stock?
But it's one of those things where, for me, honestly, it really kind of depends what you're making with it. If you're looking for more of like a base chicken stock, I would definitely say the way that I learned from Chef Brendan Collins, who was one of my favorite mentors. And please, that is not a bashing on any of the other chefs that I worked for. No, they were all amazing. Yeah.
He was a good dude.
I really learned so much about the fundamentals of cooking from this man. He's so incredibly inspiring to me. And for like just like a basic chicken stock of adding to certain ingredients, it was very, very clean, very simple. Basically, what you do is you cook the chicken bones first in water. So basically, you do a first wash and then you dump that out.
Okay.
So what that does is that it's essentially pulling out any impurities in the chicken bones.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So oftentimes, like, you'll see a chicken stock, it comes out cloudy. If you do this first wash and you dump that out, it will not come out cloudy, and you'll get this beautiful, very clear, clean, flavored stock.
Wow.
So then after you do that first wash, you add water back on top of it, add in your vegetables, any other flavorings that you want to get in there, onions, carrots, celery, herbs, whatever. You know, we used to just, you know, throw what, like, we saved all of the stems from any herbs that we use. So we would throw the stems in there because they have tons of flavor.
Whatever you want to use. Whatever you want to use.
But then, you know, at Little Dom's, we would roast our chicken bones.
Interesting. On fire?
No, just in the oven.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, basically roast them to get, and that would as well, like, pull a little bit of that blood out of the bones. But that would create a more in-depth flavor.
Interesting.
So you would get that more roasted flavor of the chicken bones. That's the whole thing that I think that is dumb about culinary school, is that they can teach you the basics.
Yeah.
And they can teach you the basic fundamentals of how to use a knife, how to do the certain different cuts, which I do think is very valuable. But at the same time, how you're really going to get good at that is, and better at it as well, is working at a restaurant.
Yeah.
Working in the field where you're cutting a bunch. I mean, when I worked at Birch for Shepherd and Collins, I used my knife there more than any other restaurant that I ever worked at. We had so much knife work involved this place.
Yeah.
Brunoising, I mean, there were certain dishes where it was just a pile of brunoise. So brunoise, basically, it's a, like, the finest, like, dice that you can get. It's very, very small squares.
How do you spell brunoise?
Brunoise.
Okay. Brunoise. Okay.
So it's a Brunoise. Brunoise. It's a French word.
Okay.
So essentially what you would do is start with a julienne, which is long strips of a vegetable or whatever it is that you are cutting up. So you create long strips with those and then turn those the other way. Cut them the other way and get nice small little squares.
Little cubes.
Yeah, nice small little cubes.
When this actually is something I wrote down for later, but I feel like it's relevant now. It's just something, this idea of, like, learning techniques and not learning replication.
Well, that's exactly what I was going to point out, was that, like, it sounds like what you're describing is when these kids, like, come out of culinary school, like, even though there may be some sort of, like, negative reputation that's connotated with, you know, having gone to culinary school, I think, like, it's for any sort of artistic, you know, person's job
endeavor.
To be able to, endeavor to be able to learn how to use the tools and how to, like, use the techniques correctly. And then you need to take those techniques and tools and apply them to your own sort of creative drive and vision. And
also, I mean, that's the thing. Like,
you can't teach people to be creative,
new ways,
right?
And always be open to learn new ways to use techniques.
Right.
Learn the techniques.
Yeah.
But be open to someone coming in and saying, I roast the chicken bones first.
Right.
That's a technique with roasting. That's a technique. How do you roast things and not burn them?
Yeah.
And, like, you know, like, that right there could be, maybe that's one of the problems, is, like, in culinary school, they're learning too much how to kind of do things one way and not necessarily understand the components of, like, learn the things you're doing.
Yeah.
I do think that culinary school can be useful in the ways of learning those basic fundamentals. But for them to tell you that you're going to come out of this being able to get a high paying sous chef or chef job is completely ridiculous, in my opinion. You're giving these people false hope.
Also, do you need it? I mean, like you're saying, you go somewhere and it's all new. Do you really need to learn the one way a school does it in order to work there? No, probably just need to start at the bottom.
That's the best way to learn.
So basically, when I decided to go to Cal Poly Pomona, I actually only ended up doing 2 years there. I decided to drop out shortly after my second year. I ended up meeting Alon Hall at the beginning of my sophomore year at Cal Poly. I was volunteering at this food and wine event that was at Universal Studios. I was there with a bunch of my friends from school. Pretty much, for the most part, what we did was polish a shit ton of forks. And if any of the people who went to this event with me, you know what I'm fucking talking about. Those goddamn norks. We were pulling them out of plastic little wrappings and polishing these bitches for,
what's
like, a hours. A nork is a fork knife. So it is something that you use for these fancy, like, food and wine events, so they can just give you one thing, so you don't have to have a fork and a knife. You know, you have this one thing that can technically cut. It's supposed to cut through a steak. It's, you know, it's difficult. But.
Interesting. I'm looking.
And then from there, we were. I actually have quite a few. Pocketed quite a few of those because we were like, oh, these things are pretty cool.
Yeah, look at this, man. The brilliant spoon for, and they're plastic, and you.
No, these are metal.
These were metal norks.
These were metal norks.
Wow. Yeah. I can't even find a Google of a metal nork. That's interesting.
And then from there, once the event actually.
Don't believe it.
Not real.
She's making it up. I think I spelled it wrong. No, how do you spell Nork?
How do you fuck up?
Do you spell it with a K or
yeah,
just.
It's a K-N-O-R-K, I believe.
Are you spelling it with O-R-K. A C?
O-R-K. Wait. Oh, I know I spelled it right. K-N-O-R-K. Yeah. Oh, whatever. Anyway, it's a cool idea. I'm sure it exists.
I mean, I have some in my apartment. I can show you.
You say so.
After the break, we'll be looking at some norks.
And so then once the actual event started, they put us in, you know, different sections of where the event was to essentially pick up.
Starting out.
Yeah, I mean, I was still in college.
Right.
And this was a volunteer thing for one of the clubs that I was involved in at my school. So I went to hospitality management school at Cal Poly. The actual name of the school was called Collins College. And they had lots of different clubs that were within the college, basically focusing on the different focuses of hospitality. Mm. So there was a restaurant club. It was, and then there was a culinary club. There was an event planners club. There was a hotel club. There was a country club, you know, there was all these different like little clubs within it that if you were interested in that focus, you could join that club. Or if you weren't quite sure what you wanted to focus in and you were just overall interested in hospitality, you could join those clubs to help you kind of go towards whichever path you wanted.
Right.
That's what a lot of people actually ended up doing who were freshmen and sophomores in the school, is that they would join almost every single one of the clubs. So then that way they could actually get a better understanding of the different aspects of hospitality.
Right.
Because there is so much more than restaurants when it comes to hospitality. And there is so much more than hotels when it comes to hospitality.
Yeah,
it's
not
just that. I mean, there's event planning, there's country clubs, there is so many different aspects of the hospitality industry.
That's interesting. That's kind of an underappreciated job market, I feel like.
Oh, yeah. And
I never even thought about that.
Well,
the whole thing
seems like it's like underappreciated, even just the restaurant industry in general.
Probably more underappreciated now than previously, too, I bet. Because now everybody like wants those real experiences.
Yeah.
I mean, you can't get those online.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So now that's like really all we have left.
Yeah, that's true.
But so for me, being interested in restaurants and cooking, I joined this restaurant club. I believe it was like Round Table for Restaurateurs or something like that. I can't remember the exact name. I feel terrible that I can't.
That's okay. You can look it up if you want to Google it.
And then I know it was like Round Table something.
Okay.
And actually that year as well, a culinary club was first established.
Okay.
And it was established by several of my friends in college.
Club.
Yeah. The original president was this guy, John Lobb, and he now, I believe, still actually is working for Houston's. He pretty much right outside of college after he graduated, he ended up getting an offer from Houston's, which is a huge restaurant company throughout the U.S. And he ended up going with them and is like now like one of their like premier executive chefs that goes and trains all of their other chefs. He's doing very well, basically.
Yeah,
so I was this in particular event was with the Round Table group for restaurateurs, and a lot of the clubs would, you know, they would find these events that we could volunteer at.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a way for us to get exposure into these types of events and meet potential people that we could work for.
Right.
And
okay.
So after the event started, they broke us up into the sections, and I was actually, I was over in the VIP section.
Mm-hmm.
And, they had a couple different, you know, restaurants that had their booths. That's essentially like how these food and wine events work, is that you walk in, they give you your glass of wine. So you get a wine glass that you can carry around with you to go try out the different wineries. And the wineries usually will have like a little water that you can swig around in your glass to rinse it out. So you're not, you know, getting, flavors on top of flavors from the different wines. And then there's restaurants as well that have little tasters of the food. And in the section that I was in, there was Bouchon, there was the Gorbals, there was several other different restaurants. And, you know, we were walking around and the chefs were setting up. They had all, you know, some of them had cooks from the restaurants there helping them out. I mean, Bouchon had this whole huge ice sculpture, this Thomas Keller's restaurant, who is very, very well known for being
very common
to
have an ice sculpture.
Yeah, you know? Well, they were doing the seafood. They were doing a cold seafood bar, so they had this like ridiculous.
Yeah, you gotta have an ice sculpture, and my seafood bars always have ice sculptures.
I mean, well, my every meal, I have an ice sculpture placed in the center of the table.
If I'm really feeling wild, I'll make a sculpture out of butter. You know, butter sculpture.
We're gonna get to butter. Get to butter.
But so. It was, and I saw this guy who I pretty much immediately recognized because I was a huge Top Chef fan.
Standing by the ice sculpture.
He was actually not standing by the ice sculpture, but he was the second season winner of Top Chef. And
oh, cool.
I recognized him immediately, and the reason why he inspired me so much when he was on Top Chef was the fact that he won when he was 24. And he wasn't a chef when he won.
Yeah.
He was just a sous chef.
Yep.
He had not been a chef de cuisine. He did not have his own restaurant.
Yeah.
And he won this competition having very minimal experience.
Yeah.
And it was one of those things where like I was like, that's fucking badass.
Yeah.
Like, this dude is badass. He's super crazy, super loud and obnoxious.
Yeah.
And
he was
I
on
like
TV.
Yeah.
Dude.
And and I saw him and I was like, I have to, like, there's no way that I can't not go up to this guy and talk to him.
He's John McEnroe of the chef's world, huh?
And so, of course, I went up and talked.
John McEnroe,
I would...
dude.
What? You don't know who John McEnroe is?
What does he do?
He's a famous tennis player. He's a dude that used to scream at everybody and flip out on the court.
That's so funny. You used to play tennis, right?
Yeah.
Did you want to be John McEnroe, dude?
No, I did not.
If you saw him, would you go talk to him?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. So he was your John. This chef, what was the chef's name that won?
Alon Hall.
Alon Hall.
What's the matter? You haven't heard of Alon Hall?
I've never heard of Alon Hall, dude. I was going to look that up, too. I forgot the name, though. Alanhall. Is that Alon Hall? He looks cool. He looks like a cool guy. Best known as the winner of the second season of the reality series Top Chef.
Yeah.
Bravo Network. Network Nights at 8. No, I'm kidding. I didn't say what time. That's awesome, dude. I love those cooking shows. I watch a ton of those. Like, I really like Top Chef? No, not Master Chef.
Master Chef.
Yeah. I really like Master Chef. I don't know. I just like Gordon Ramsay. He's funny to watch. And all the people on there are funny too. But anyway. So
that's actually funny because I wanted to ask you, is Gordon Ramsay, like, do you know? Is he the real
deal?
Is he the real deal?
Right?
Is he good or is he not? Like, is he, what are we talking?
He's not that good anymore, right?
To be honest, I don't know that much about Gordon Ramsay.
Interesting.
For the most part of my career, I try to avoid people like that because.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's a dick, right?
Yeah.
No, Gordon Ramsay's not a dick. He's not. He's only a dick on a couple American shows, but supposedly in real life, he's pretty chill.
Yeah.
Oh, I mean, so, but like in.
He just does it on TV, dude. He's fucking with us. He's trolling everybody.
He's the Trump of the fucking.
He's trolling us hard.
He's
dude.
The Trump of the chef world, huh?
He kind of is, maybe, dude.
I mean,
yeah.
For me, I've just never really been super into the idea of. Like, Gordon Ramsay is what I like to call a corporate chef.
Yeah. Like,
and I have never had any form of an interest in that. Bobby Flay.
Yeah. See, we've heard of all these guys.
Yeah.
We haven't heard of Alon Hall. Oh, no. Alon Hall was on TV, though.
Yeah, he was on TV, but he did not have a corporate style restaurant.
What year did he win, though? The second season?
The second season.
So this was a while ago.
Yeah, this was a while ago. This was a long time ago.
Okay.
He was, like I said, he was 24 when he won it. So
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I interrupted your story. You went into a long haul.
But, and so I ended up meeting him, and he told me, he was like, look, he's like, I'm opening up a restaurant in LA, you know, you should come by and check it out. And so about a month after this event, I was in the culinary club, and we were looking for ways to essentially raise money for the club, because what we wanted, so the club had just been started that year, and what the president really wanted to do was that at the end of the year, he wanted to be able to take everybody out for dinner and offer them at a discounted price, because we're all college students. I mean, you know, we can't eat, you know, we can't afford to go do a $200 tasting menu at a restaurant.
Yeah.
And so we wanted to try and raise as much money as we could to try and offer the members as much of a discount as possible. It wasn't a required thing to go, but obviously we wanted to offer it to all of the members for a discounted price. And
it's pretty awesome.
Yeah. And so we were looking for ways to be able to raise money for that. And so I told them, I was like, oh, you know, I met this awesome chef at this event. Like, maybe we could talk to him about doing a demo for us.
Yeah.
And so I called them at the restaurant. I just looked up on Google the phone number for the Gorables. And I called them and talked to their general manager, who was Alon's best friend, Natan. And he told me, yeah, like, we'll set up a meeting. And so myself and a couple of my, you know, like my fellow students that were part of the club went in there, and we sat down and talked to them, and they were very, very interested in what we wanted to do. And they said, you know, we've been looking for opportunities like this to basically just kind of get the name of the restaurant out there, because we just recently opened and we think that this would be a really good opportunity. And at the end of the conversation, Alon looked at us and he was like, oh, you know, I'm looking for, you know, some help, because, you know, we're just starting up and I don't have a lot of money, but I'm looking, you know, for some interns. Do anybody from your school or from your club want to be an intern here? And I looked at him and I was like, I'll come work for you for free.
Yeah.
And he was like, when do you want to come? And he was like, I have an event for my wife. His wife worked for Urban Outfitters. She's actually the visual director for Urban Outfitters. And she was like, oh, my wife has this event that we're throwing here tomorrow night, and I really need a bunch of help, like as much help as I can get. And I was like, I'm gonna bring five guys with me. So I, you know, hit up a bunch of my friends from school, and we all showed up, and we rolled a buck ton of matzo balls.
We
helped them do this event, and it was super awesome, and he was super appreciative, and I basically just kept coming back.
Nice. Yeah, that's great.
And
yeah.
I mean, I was essentially paying to work there.
Yeah,
because
yeah, yeah.
I was living in Pomona at the time.
Yeah.
And this restaurant was in downtown inside the Alexandria Hotel.
Yeah.
And so I was driving every weekend 30 minutes to downtown Los Angeles and paying for parking to go and work for this guy
because
I wanted to be there and I wanted to learn everything that I could from him.
Yeah.
Well, that's always like, I feel like that's so rare, but that's always the goal, is to find like somebody that's working in the industry, doing it well.
Yeah.
You know, making money and like impressing you with their talent and design and their plating and their taste and their palate and their technique and everything. You know, it's like always the ideal situation is where you find somebody that's willing to help you develop your skills, but also like you can provide that. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's so rare.
He was only 28 at the time when he first opened up the Gorbals. He was like 28, 29, I believe, at this time. So it was only 4 years after he won Top Chef.
Yeah.
And he was looking for people that were going to be inspired by his cooking, because he was doing a lot of weird shit.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of his food was it was based around offal. So
what is offal?
So offal is Offal is the parts of animals that people generally throw away.
Yeah, oh. I would do that. I would throw that away. Whatever it is that you're about to tell us.
Yeah, what is it?
We had a wonderful beef tongue dish.
Oh, beef tongue.
Chicken gizzards.
Beef tongue is good. You've never had it, have you? You've never had it. It's delicious. Beef tongue
You're half Mexican and you haven't ever had lengua tacos?
Greg, I
Hey, come on. I don't eat the carne asada, okay?
It freaks me out, too, but I'll tell you what, man. I had beef tongue by accident at Korean barbecue, and it was freaking
delicious. Doesn't surprise me at all. I hate Korean barbecue.
You do? You sit
there and cook your own meat?
What do you mean you do? He doesn't like it.
Oh, that's right. I've invited you. You're like, I hate it.
I hate it.
Because he doesn't want to smell like food.
No, it fucking sticks to you for days, and I work out, and I'm sweating, and I'm like, I feel like I'm a piece of the meat that I was eating yesterday, and I'm burping it up. It's disgusting. Just fucking stick to the basics. It doesn't...
I don't know what to tell you, dog. It's like one of my favorite ways.
So we're gonna go eat Korean barbecue because he will never go with me. And
you haven't been to every Korean barbecue place.
I've been to them all, bro.
Oh no,
no, you've been to the worst one where the shit sticks to you, dude. I never go to that one.
I've been to all of them.
I never go to the ones where it sticks to you, bro. Yeah, that's just a rookie mistake right there.
That's I think that's you. You're just like you're unaware that you smell like. Butt beef or whatever.
I smell like beef tongue. And
you smell like beef butt and you're just
not aware
of it.
The ladies love a man that reeks of fresh beef tongue. I don't know what you're talking about, Greg. You're out of your fucking
Oh, that's your new cologne, huh? That's your new cologne.
Beef tongue.
Beef butt by Alex Van Dyne.
Beef butt by Alex Van Dyne.
But
order it today and you'll get a free complimentary beef tongue.
Back to Offal, you know, we did tripe, all kinds of weird shit.
Cool.
Lamb neck. Oh, we did this wonderful lamb neck dish that was to die for. We would braise it in red wine and a bunch of other delicious things.
What do you do with all the little bones in the neck?
You just don't eat that.
Do you take the bones out? Is there enough meat on the neck?
Oh, yeah. We serve the whole neck.
Oh, I'm thinking of a chicken neck I ate one time by accident, and it was gross.
No, well, you ate pigeon, too, bro.
I didn't eat the neck. I let the neck
go.
You
could have eaten that whole fucking head, beak and all, eyeballs.
I took a pretty big risk taking any bite of that.
I've eaten a duck head, so...
Yeah. Gross. I mean...
I've eaten some pretty weird shit.
Do you eat the brain of the duck head?
Yeah.
You just ate the brain?
Yeah.
Straight up?
And
I never ate brain. Never ate brain, dude.
Oh, I've eaten brain.
That's why you're dumb, bro. That's why you're dumb.
Never had brain, dude. I hear about eating the brain. I feel like if we were in the wild, I would just like eat the animal and get to the brain, and I would just like.
If we were in the wild, man, you wouldn't think about it.
I probably wouldn't know it's the brain.
No,
I wouldn't know it's
you would
the
be
brain.
Stupid. Yeah. You'd be stupid if you were in the wild. If we were in
like,
the wild,
oh, they're so good. Yeah. I'm eating its brain. Oh yeah. God, it's gross. That grosses me out more than tongue.
Yeah,
dude.
But that's the thing is the brain, like, so the thing about the brain is the brain always looks like brain. You can't chop it up unless you're, like, grinding that shit up into some sort of chuck. You know what I mean? Like, it's going to look like brain, I feel
like.
Yeah,
maybe if you diet.
That's the problem is, as long as it doesn't look like what it is, I could probably eat it.
Yeah, that's why I ate beef tongue. It didn't look like tongue.
Oh, it didn't?
No,
okay. If I see that shit, if I see a big slab of a fucking chopped off tongue... And that's in a hoagie roll or some shit with mustard.
Korean barbecue, or smelling like beef butt.
Yes, that's in a hoagie roll. Like, I'm just fucking vomiting right there, dude.
How we actually did the beef tongue is so we boiled them whole, and they are pretty gross when you get them in. I mean, they're these big, giant, like...
Tongues.
They are what I expect.
Yeah,
they are
exactly.
What they say,
And so you boil them, because they're really, really tough. I mean, the tongue is one of the strongest muscles in the body.
Yeah, and
so you have to boil the shit out of it to get it super tender.
Okay.
And so we would boil it, then we would peel the outer layer of the skin.
Yeah. No, I love it. Keep going.
And then
I do. It's fascinating.
We'd slice it, and then we would keep it in warm oil with like a bunch of garlic and herbs and stuff. And so it would look like little steaks, you know?
Yeah, little steaks.
And then we'd pull it out, season it,
cubed,
and then
cube tongue.
And then we put it on the plancha and get it super crispy on each
side. What's a plancha?
Plancha is a flat top.
Oh, okay.
So like a flat, like a griddle.
Giant flat griddle.
Yeah, it is.
We call that
Spanish
the comal.
Version.
We call that the comal in Mexico.
Oh, well, in Spain, it's the plancha.
Yiddish, it's the schpitz. No,
the
I'm kidding.
Schpitz?
No, I'm just
you
making
got
shit
the
up.
Schpitz?
I don't know what you call it.
That sounds like some sort of...
Throw it on the spitz! Get it like spitzed up.
Some sort of Jewish disease, too.
I've got the spitz!
I've got the spitz! I can't go out! It's a whole thing!
But from the get-go, you know, I was cooking with some pretty weird stuff. And, yeah. and the thing That's that cool. I loved working for Alon was the fact that because he was a younger chef, he really loved bouncing ideas off of everybody else. Like he would stay late after work all the time. And when I first, so after I decided to drop out of college, I ended up doing an exchange program in Italy called Apicius. My college was associated with this culinary school in Italy in Florence, where they did like a little exchange program, and it was just like a month or two long. Mm-hmm. And so I went there with a big group of students from my school, and my dean went out there as well with his family, and it was really, really fun. It was a really great experience. I'm super, super happy that I took advantage of that because I got to do this program that is normally incredibly expensive. Because I mean, people who were in my class who did it just straight out of pocket, they were telling me that they were spending like upwards of $15,000 to $20,000 just to be there, plus having to find an apartment and all of this.
Oh my God,
as opposed to how I did it through my school.
Yeah.
I paid like $4,000, flight included, got an apartment. Like they included an apartment, all the schooling. Really, really, really great.
So you went to a regular college, but you got these programs to help you in the regular college to do culinary
And this program,
instead of going into a culinary
college. Exactly. Yeah. And this program was centered around Italian food. So I took an Italian cooking class, and I took a Italian wine class. And they were very, very informative. I would show up late all the time because I was 20 and
it was
free
labor,
in...
Right? Oh,
no. Was this not... No, this was school.
This was school. Okay.
And but I would show up late all the time because I was 20 and I was living in Europe. So I was like, fuck this. I'm going to go get drunk every night, partied, all of that.
Europe's
and so
that.
I would show up late all the time. Europe. And I still got one of the best grades in class because, I mean, I knew what I was doing.
Yeah.
And it was so funny, like when every single day they would partner us up with, you know, somebody else, and all the people that were part from my school would like fight like over who would be my partner for the day. It was really always funny because they'd be like, oh no, we want to, like, I want to be with Liz. No. you know, because they knew that they would get a good grade for that day.
Yeah.
But when I finished the program, my chef instructor actually offered to have me come back as his student teacher, but my visa was I didn't have a visa.
Okay.
So I only, you can only be in a country for a certain amount of time for up to 3 months.
Yeah.
And so since I didn't have like the proper visas, I had to come back to the US already. And before I had even left for this program, because I knew I wasn't returning back to college, I had worked out a living situation.
So
I already had like this deposit down on this apartment where I was going to be living with a roommate in downtown Los Angeles. So when I came back, I pretty much already had like everything set in stone for me to have a place to live.
Yeah.
And so when I came back, I was living in this real gross apartment in downtown Los Angeles.
Yeah.
It was super tiny. Had a roommate. I lived above this Vietnamese restaurant in
below
downtown.
Below crackhead, above Vietnamese restaurant.
Shared bathrooms.
Oh, shit.
Yeah. It was like an adult dorm.
Gross. Yeah, that's weird.
And we lived right next to the landlord who fucking fought with his wife
all
the time.
Wow.
And it was very unpleasant. I only lived there for a couple of months.
That sounds like a movie right there.
Yeah. I only lived there for a couple of months.
This guy fucking yelling at his wife. Just trying to survive, you know?
But I got the, I was living there, and when I came back, I pretty much was like, okay, I gotta find a job.
Yeah.
And I applied to some places, did some stages. Stage is basically when you go to a restaurant and you work for free for a day.
Okay.
You go, sometimes it's not free.
What's it called? Stage?
Stage.
How do you spell that? S-T-A-J?
Yeah. Basically, like.
Stage.
Yeah.
I'm doing a stage over in 96th Street.
I'd only do my stages at like 7-Eleven, a.m., p.m.
Some ghetto stodging right there, bro.
I was having trouble, you know, finding a job because a lot of people weren't hiring at the time.
Right.
It was at a time
what
where...
What year was this?
This was 2009? In 2000... Yeah, 2009?
2008, 2009 was pretty rough.
Yeah, no, but... I think it was 2010, actually.
Okay, 2010.
Yeah, I think this was in 2010.
Yeah.
And, I was having trouble finding something because, I mean, just not a lot of people were hiring because this was right when, you know, cooking was becoming really popular.
Right.
There was a lot of people who were interested in working in restaurants because they wanted to be the next big name chef and blah, 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 and all of that. And everybody thought that, like, you know, that they were going to become the next celebrity chef.
Oh, yeah.
And so it was very difficult for me to find a job. And I did a stage at this restaurant in downtown in the Arts District called Church and State that day. And I remember, like, I ended up feeling super confident after the stage, but the chef told me, he was like, I'm actually not hiring right now, but he was like, I did really like you, and so I want to keep your information.
Why did he
down.
Have you in if he wasn't hiring?
Free labor.
Fucker, dude.
I'm actually still
I'm not hiring right now. I'm just stodging.
But
yeah.
I'm just getting stodges, but I love your info. Yeah, that's good that he got your info.
But
that's good that
to
your
go
info.
Back to that, I am actually still very, very good friends with that chef.
Yeah.
And he
it's
has
like an
offered
internship.
Me many jobs in the past that I have actually turned down.
Yeah.
He offered me a job a couple years ago, actually. Actually, he now works, he's the chef of a restaurant in Vegas called Bardot. And he offered me a sous chef position a couple years ago.
Shit.
Like, told me like he would help me move out there, and like it was going to be really, really, you know, actually make some pretty good money because working in Vegas, working in the restaurant industry, you actually make some pretty damn good money.
Well, yeah, really? Vegas is basically a money pit.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, that's interesting because that's another thing that I want to talk. Yeah.
Food.
Wait, gambling what and food?
Gambling, sex, food, man.
Sex and
that
food.
Is.
That's true.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But I also actually want to talk about that because. It's weird that it seems to be profitable in Vegas, but not profitable here. Like, I wonder why. Is it just, like, oversaturation competition?
Well, what it comes down to is the fact that all of these restaurants in Vegas are in hotels.
Yeah.
So they get benefits of the hotels.
Right, but I'm curious, like, how does a restaurant in a hotel do better than just a... So that I can understand. Okay.
It has built-in
so people
clientele.
Are going to come there no matter what.
Yeah. Because you have a hotel, so you're selling space to people to live.
Okay.
And then, look, below them.
I mean,
the same
deal goes for Bazaar here in Los Angeles. It's in the SLS.
Yeah.
And
well, I've
know
been there.
I know several people who work there, and they tell you, like, you start off at $17, $18 an hour, which is super high for starting off as a line cook.
Really?
That is, usually most small restaurants, small chef-owned restaurants, they're starting you off at minimum wage. And that's no question.
Because they can.
Like,
so
oftentimes, they don't even tell you what you're making, because they're like, oh, you just should assume that you're going to be making minimum wage.
So what is a head chef making normally?
At a chef-driven restaurant or at a hotel?
Either, both.
I mean, at a
hotel,
they're
going to be... Let's
say you
start out as a chef somewhere. It's your first chef job.
It's your first...
How much are you asking for?
Yeah.
I mean...
Or theoretically, what's the range?
What's the range? Yeah, what's the normal range for, like, a place that...
For a small chef-driven restaurant,
it's also high-end food. Like, because nothing we're talking about right now is, like, you know...
I'm talking about McDonald's. No, I'm kidding.
So for high-end food for a chef-driven restaurant, a small chef-driven restaurant that is not associated with a hotel, you're going to be looking at somewhere between... $55,000 and $80,000 a year.
Okay, yeah.
Wow, dude.
Yes.
Yeah. Dude, that's an intense job, and that's not that much money.
Yeah, but that's you're starting out. Like,
55
if you're really
to
good,
80?
You can probably ask for a lot more.
No.
Not necessarily.
No,
oh,
dude.
Really?
55 to 80. 80 is sort of the max, right? 85 is kind of the max.
Yeah, I mean, it's really, unless you're the owner, and even if you're the owner, you're probably still not bringing in that much.
Man, that's
it's
such
really,
a bummer.
It's really, really hard.
Oh, the margins are pretty low.
Because the thing is that you have to understand, especially in a city like Los Angeles, the rent is ridiculous.
Yeah, dude.
If you're the owner, like, you're having to... basically take in the bare minimum.
Yeah.
Maybe the price of food just needs to go up.
I met a
you know
restaurant
what I mean?
But then
owner
people
recently.
Don't come to your restaurant. And
but
that's
what
and
I'm
that's
saying.
And that's another...
If the price, like, sort of locally of food just went up all for every restaurant, just everything increased in price, then it would, you know, people would be like, well, I have to pay.
I met this guy recently, dude, and he was a restaurateur, and he was telling me that he was like, I only make like fucking, I think he said 2-5%. On his investments, you know,
and
but he invests a shitload of money. The thing so is he makes a shitload of money.
It's not necessarily the problem of that we're not charging enough. It's that people aren't willing to spend enough. Because when you start charging more, people start ordering less.
Right, but what I'm saying is that if the price of food for everything went up from McDonald's to the Gorbals, if the price of food went up for all of those places. Like, people would still, they'd be like, oh, well, my Big Mac is, like, $12 now. So I guess it's not unreasonable for me to be charged, you know, $75 for a plate or whatever.
But then they're going to start eating out less.
Yeah.
I mean, that could be the case. Yeah.
Well,
and that's something that every restaurant goes through, is that you go through these period of times where, especially, like, around the holidays. So before the holidays, restaurants generally get super busy.
Okay.
Holiday parties, people having family come in, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
After the holidays, it's like dead season. It hurts restaurants so much because people aren't spending any money because they just spent all of their money.
Right, okay.
So it's like oftentimes after the holidays, restaurants really struggle.
Yeah.
Like in the summer, sometimes restaurants can really struggle because people are spending all their money on going on vacation.
Right.
Unless you're in a location where you're bringing in a lot of tourists.
Yeah.
You know, you can really struggle in the summer
because
people are out of town and they're spending money on going on vacation. They're not wanting to spend their money on going out to eat.
So how do we get, like, let's say you have the power to change this industry somehow so that chefs make more, you know?
Yeah.
Like, what's the solution, do you think, for that, you know, so that people can make, like, a living wage? I'm not saying, like, chefs need to be paid $1 million a year or $3 million a year, but like something that's reasonable that, you know, you could live a comfortable lifestyle and not have to worry about money.
$80,000 a year is, that people consider that in LA. That's like
the average.
Lowest you probably want to be making. If you
in Los Angeles, the average medium salary is, I believe, around $85,000.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you're still, even if you're making only $80,000 a year being a chef, you're below the average.
Yeah, but that's
so crazy because, like, it's such an intense job, you know?
I think it's actually, so there's a lot of factors to, like, how food is made, and you'd have to look at each of those, you know? And if you look at, like, some restaurants, I mean, maybe not, these aren't even restaurants, but the idea of... This is what McDonald's did, right? They said, let's take food and let's turn it into a process that we can streamline to make cheaper.
Right.
Right? And so the problem is, though, is that tends to, like, reduce the quality of food. Is there some way you could retain the quality of food but also, like, make the process cheaper? You know?
Well, I mean, it all kind of...
So that a chef could make their food without spending a ton of money.
I don't know. So you're thinking, like, without spending a ton of time and energy, you could still make something good and not spending a ton of money.
Yeah.
You could make a profit.
You can make a profit.
Instead of, like, making $80,000 a year, you'd be making $150,000 or $160,000, but, like, you're not putting in as much time and energy.
You've eliminated something.
Yeah.
Or you've changed something.
Got it.
I mean, if your restaurant is consistently busy, oftentimes you're going to be able to pay people what they need to be paid to be able to live a reasonable lifestyle.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, we recently went and ate at Bestia. That restaurant is always fucking busy. It's super hard to get a reservation. Mm-hmm. The only reason why I was able to get us a reservation is because I'm friends with one of their managers.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You
totally.
Know?
Yeah.
It's
always busy. And
I don't remember because I didn't pay, but the food wasn't super, I don't remember it being super expensive.
It doesn't have to be.
It doesn't have to be. And the thing is
I'm just thinking about, like, from the perspective of the chef. Like, if my job were to, you know, and at a certain point, my job was to be the designer that would put in the extra time and effort and energy and hours in the day and stay late and really just, like, grind away in order to get better at this craft. You know, because at that point, it's worth it for you. But, like, when you're a head chef, that's kind of like being the creative director of a studio. And you've been working, like... many years to hone your craft. You understand, like, the principles of design, and you understand, like, what improves things. You understand how to articulate ideas to people to improve their work and all these things. And so there's, like, a certain amount of value that comes with putting in a lot of time and effort and energy and having that experience. And I feel like as a head chef, that's the person that has all of that time and energy and effort expended already put in. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I feel like they should be compensated at a higher level than 80 grand a year.
I think one of the things I would like to say, though, is I'm pretty sure if you're a chef, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but if you're like a chef that has notoriety, you create a restaurant. That restaurant has more pull to a certain degree to people. If you have notoriety, or because the only other factors is like, if I'm going to go out and eat, what how do I choose it? Well, first of all, have I heard of it? Right, my friend told me. Okay, I got to try it out.
Yeah.
Have I heard of the place somehow on the internet through some kind of channel? I'm interested in something. I hear about it. Like, there's only so many ways you'll hear about it. Then there's also like, how close am I to it?
Yeah.
You know, a restaurant, like, you can only get so many people.
A lot of what comes down to a restaurant being busy is its reputation. One of the reasons why Bestia is so busy is because they've had a reputation pretty much ever since they opened that they are one of the best restaurants in the city of Los Angeles.
And because they probably are.
Yeah.
Do they come with a big name, like a big chef name that's already got notoriety?
No, so they basically... They talked to the right people. They had the right people come in, review the restaurant. Restaurant reviews are a big thing. If you get a good restaurant review by a well-known reviewer, one of the biggest food critics in the world is Jonathan Gold. You get a good review from Jonathan Gold,
you're golden.
I remember, like, we actually, at Gorbals, we were on Jonathan Gold's 101 list.
Yeah.
There's an amazing documentary on him as well. But he's a very, very interesting man.
I've seen him on some shows.
Yeah, yeah.
He is pretty funny looking.
Yeah, no, he's definitely a funny looking guy.
He looks awesome. You gotta look on Jonathan Gold, man. Dude, this guy's rad. He's got suspenders. He's got long hair.
Yeah.
But like balding long hair. It's awesome, dude. He looks like he's
There's another really well-known food critic from the LA Times, Basha Riddell. And she actually, like, for a long time, I don't know if this is still the situation, because I've been out of the business for a little while, but for a while, a lot of people didn't know what she looked like. So it was always this question of, like, if you ever, saw somebody, like, you know, we think that's Basha Riddell. That's Basha Riddell.
Basha Riddell. You know?
How did Jonathan Gold come to be somebody that has the same, I guess we
would have to watch the documentary about him to fully understand how he came about into his career as a food critic. But one of the things that I've always really appreciated about him is that he goes to such a massive variety of restaurants throughout Los Angeles. I mean, I have been to several of the restaurants that are on his list, and I mean, one of my favorites is Meals by Jeanette, which is an Ethiopian restaurant in Little Ethiopia.
Okay.
And if you have not been and you have never tried Ethiopian food, go, because it is so much fun. You eat everything with your hands. There's no utensils.
What's the name of this place? Sorry.
It is called Meals by Jeanette.
Meals by Jeanette.
Yeah, it's right by you, too.
Yeah, it's right, yeah.
I'm pretty sure that's on the street that I live on.
It's on Fairfax, so.
So I literally have walked by it, and I've never been there.
Yeah, it's on Fairfax, and it's right in the middle of Little Ethiopia, and the food is absolutely incredible. Very, very spicy. Most Ethiopian food is vegan and vegetarian. Okay. So if you have a vegan friend and you've been looking for a place to take them, go to Meals by Jeanette.
Grease charcoal. I'm coming for you, buddy.
That's right. He's newly vegan.
Yeah, and he bothers me about it every time we eat.
Fucking speaking annoying. Of vegans, he's one of those annoying vegans, huh? Yeah. He adopted the mentality. Well, he's I'm gonna like, be
he's
vegan.
Like, it's cool. He can go anywhere. And I guess someone was like, "Is it vegan?" I'm like, "You just told me we could go anywhere. Now you're gonna be a dick about it." He gets some French fries.
But speaking of vegan food, I did actually go and eat at a vegan restaurant yesterday that is originally from my hometown.
What's it called?
It is called Cafe Gratitude. I'm sure many people have heard of it. It has expanded widely throughout California.
Is it a franchise? Or is it just a privately owned?
Do they franchise it? They might have franchised it. Yeah. Back in the day when I first would go there to the original location in Berkeley, it was not, you know, it was just the one location. Yeah. And I loved it. I mean, growing up, like, I would go there and I loved the food there. I think that they actually make some pretty impressive vegan food.
Yeah.
They have this, like, chocolate avocado mousse pie that is like stupid good that you would have absolutely no idea that it's vegan.
Yeah, I whipped some of that up this morning.
But it is one of the most obnoxious places to go eat.
Yeah.
Because they name every single one of these dishes these stupid names.
What kind of names? What are we talking about? Like
Bright, Immunity, Vitality.
Oh.
You know, Shielder. And they insist upon you saying these names.
Jim.
They have the question of the day. Dude, and
we should make a
liquidity.
We should have a pop-up. We should have a pop-up restaurant where we do the opposite. We name our food like garbage bag. But it's like amazing.
Toilet shell.
Yeah.
Ceramic. Lumber. Just name them like elements.
No, but name them like terrible, shitty things.
Well, I wouldn't want to eat lumber, you know? Sounds terrible.
But my point with that is that
I can picture a restaurant doing that. Yeah.
I've always felt really terrible about the stigma around vegan food because I honestly think that vegan food can be really, really, really good.
Yeah.
I've had some really amazing vegan food in my career and I've made
some really amazing vegan dishes. Yeah, that you like something off the top of your head. What's something you made that you liked that was vegan?
Well, actually, at the,
what was in it?
At the first restaurant that I was chef de cuisine at, it was the Corner Door in Culver City, and I made a point of where. So when I started working there, they had zero vegan dishes.
Oh yeah, whoops.
And
fix that.
They had a lot of dishes that could be made vegan, but they didn't have a dish that was solely vegan as it was on its own.
Right.
And that was something that I said. You got to change that. We're in Los Angeles. People are very health conscious. This is something that people are continuously thinking about. And I can't, almost every single night, I have had somebody come into a restaurant that I work at that says that they're vegan.
Mm.
And it's something...
It's a popular fad right now.
Yeah. And
I mean, it's not even that. I think people are just like, I don't want to hurt anything, you know?
Which is a
like,
fad. Yeah, that's a fad. One day we'll be back to...
As soon as the power goes out, everyone will be ripping each other's heads off
exactly.
and drinking their blood.
Yeah, seriously. I'm bathing blood now. What's the problem?
I'm not vegan anymore, goddamn. I can't survive out here with the zombies being vegan. It doesn't work.
See how long Reese lasts as a vegan during the apocalypse. Yeah.
I can't lift a goddamn thing. I got no muscle mass. Oh, Jesus. I broke a bone.
You'll wake up one day and he'll be eating your toes.
No, we've got to stay vegan.
But I did.
Don't eat my toes. Please, vegan. Oh.
But I did this. I did this roasted carrot salad, and so it was roasted carrots, baby carrots. We get these beautiful baby carrots from the farmer's market delivered to us, and we would roast them with cumin and coriander. And then I made this carrot puree that was totally vegan that I would cook with like onions and some ginger.
So you pureed the carrot to make a, almost like a butter, carrot butter kind of something.
Carrot puree, basically. Yeah.
So you can make it mushy.
Yeah, it was a carrot puree and it would be smooth and it had a lot of flavor in it.
Yeah,
I put a lot of olive oil in it to try and compensate for that fat content that you would be missing from something like butter.
Right.
And it had toasted hazelnuts on it. And then one thing that I also really always like to stand by in my cooking is trying to use as much of the ingredients as you can. So we would garnish it with cilantro, which, you know, we would use coriander in the seasoning. So cilantro is actually from coriander. It's the same thing. Mm. A lot of people don't know that.
I didn't know that. I had no idea.
You can take coriander seeds and plant them in your yard, and eventually some cilantro will sprout.
What do they call it?
Coriander.
Why is it called two different things?
That is fucking... That just blew my mind. I had no idea. I've been living... I feel like the Matrix. I just drank down the blue pill. I can't wake up now.
Fuck.
They're going to come get me, bro. I know about coriander and cilantro, dude. They're both the same thing.
Man, the Illuminati is going to show up at your doorstep.
Damn it.
But I would also that's use amazing, the no,
thank you for
the carrot tops to garnish the salad,
which I usually throw away.
Yeah, most people throw them away. And the thing was that I wouldn't just take the carrot tops and like put them on top of it, because I mean, hey, that's not really going to bring that much to the dish. What we would do is we would toss the carrot tops with all of the carrot, the roasted carrots, with this lemon vinaigrette that we would make, and we toss it all together.
Yeah.
So the greens were all coated in this great dressing,
right.
And put those on top, and it would bring this element of, first off, it would create height to the dish. Mm. So we would kind of like stack up. I remember like I had this guy that worked for me who was just, for some reason, would struggle so much with plating this dish. I don't know why, because always tell him higher. So you need height in it.
Higher.
Because when it comes down to it,
it must be higher.
We eat with our eyes first. So to tell him it's gotta be pretty. You gotta make it pretty.
No, for sure. And you're just saying, listen, motherfucker, stack it higher.
Yeah. And so we
get that height.
That's how Alex gives direction. Listen here, motherfucker, stack that shit higher.
And we'd also there was pluots in it as well. So those are plum apricots. So they have a really like nice, beautiful kind of purple color to it.
Okay.
And so we'd have all, you know, these beautiful. This beautiful bright orange puree on the bottom, and then we'd shingle these carrots with the plums, and then finish it off with the green cilantro and the carrot tops, and then hazelnuts, which would create another textural component.
Yeah.
So one of the things about cooking is that a lot of people don't realize, especially when you're creating a dish at a restaurant where it's going to be a composed dish. Because oftentimes when we make food for ourselves at home, we're making like, you know, a protein, a vegetable, a salad. You know, it's not a composed type of thing of where you're putting it all together on one plate.
No, mine is when just like stacks of food. Yeah.
Exactly. But when you're
casserole man, huh?
No. I'll have my meat. And then there's my vegetables.
And have my meat.
And there's maybe some kind of other vegetable. You know?
But when you're creating a dish at a restaurant, you want it to be a composed dish where every flavor profile is building off itself.
Yeah.
And you want to have texture as well.
Yeah.
And color. Like these things are very important, because when it comes down to it, the first impression that somebody's going to have of that dish is the way it looks.
Yeah.
The color is like, to me, when you were talking about it, you kept saying these, like, the color of this and the color of this. And the stuff I saw you make, you know, which we should talk about.
Oh, yeah.
The colors were, it was almost like you had, when you envision a dish, do you envision the colors of the things you're putting on there? Like, do you see it in your head first? Did you just fucking
Or is it
that?
Organic? Yeah. Are you just coming to it like, okay, this
do
has got
some you have
it
in front of you
this
and you
need
some red,
this needs some green.
It really depends, I think, on the circumstance. I mean, I can't tell you how many times I've plated something and then I've been like, oh, wait. No, but I should have added this, you know? Mm-hmm. Or I could have done this to make it better.
Well,
It's always something of where you're building off of it. But something that, you know, one of the chefs that I worked for, you know, taught me is that you could always make it better.
Yeah.
Interesting.
You know, you should never accept it for what it is. Yes, it could be amazing and you could think that it's perfect, but in reality, you should always be striving to make it better.
Yeah.
I think that's probably true for anything, you know.
That's also, and that's actually, it's like, don't sit on your laurels, you know, too much. You know, I think you got to make sure that you are constantly evolving.
Yeah.
And that's actually something I wanted to talk about. One thing I'm noticing with Liz, and I think with everybody, and myself included, that's kind of been on this path of creativity, is like you should always find those people that, you know, inspire you.
Yeah.
You know,
definitely.
Always be looking for people that inspire you. that show you new technique. But here's the thing, because I was going to talk about, you know, I found this new, or a new tutorial just came out on Video Copilot. Yeah. I was telling you about it.
Yeah.
Andrew Kramer, Video Copilot, great resource if you're trying to do, you know, visual effects compositing, basically.
Or I think just design, you know, too. He's got a lot of cool tricks that you could learn.
Yeah, well, they're visual tricks, yeah. Like, he teaches visual tricks using After Effects mostly. Yeah. And one of the things I love that he does, he uses effects that are native to After Effects.
Right.
Or he releases a plugin.
And then he says, you gotta get this plugin.
You know? Yeah. The great thing is, well, he puts out, I would say, half his plugins are free.
Yeah, that's true.
And the other half are reasonably priced.
Yeah.
He doesn't price you out of being able to create shit.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. You know? It's super affordable.
But anyway, he generally uses effects that are native to the After Effects, but he uses them in ways that, and that's what this new tutorial was so cool to me about. He shows you all these effects that you could use in a multitude of ways.
Yeah.
You don't have to do what he did. You don't have to recreate exactly what he did. And a lot of people watch tutorials nowadays or learn nowadays, and they're just copying what someone's showing them.
Right.
They're not understanding the pieces, the steps you're taking can be rearranged, reorganized, reintegrated with other shit that you've learned. You know?
Well, that's a big part of, like, for any designer, anybody that's in sort of a creative field should be taking their mentors or the people that they admire or their heroes and looking at why those things that they do succeed and, like, understand why they succeed. Because that's the value. It's not, like, being able to replicate what they made. The value is understanding, like, the process of the why pieces. Those things work together, you know what I mean? So that you can apply those, like, tricks and tools to your own toolkit, you know?
And by using, like, you know, the tools that are in front of you, yeah, you can learn techniques, not replication. So,
yeah.
We're going to take a break here for 1 second, and when we come back, we're going to talk to Liz about her dish and what she created, and we'll continue the journey of
food.
We are back with Liz. What's your last name, Liz?
Freeman.
Like,
this is the free foodie.
Also, oh, the Half-Life. Shout out to Half-Life Freeman. No? Anybody play Half-Life? Dude, there's an epic video game character with the last name Freeman. From Half-Life. You're the main... It's you. You play Freeman.
You are Freeman.
And aliens are attacking, and you're fucking... Like, you're a security guard, kind of, and you just have this, like, suit. Or no, you're a scientist, and you have this suit, and fucking shit goes down, and you gotta, like, save everyone's life.
What's the one that you showed me where you, like, walk around and build shit, and it's, like... You're picking up parts, and you're, like, building in this apocalyptic world...
Oh.
Random things. It's like in the VR world. It's like a VR game.
Oh, it was a VR game? I don't remember. Oh, no. Oh, yeah. Fallout. You're thinking of Fallout.
Fallout.
Fallout's such a good game. All right, we're getting off topic, though. Liz Freeman, thank you for joining us today. We've had a great time talking. We're going to talk now about what you created, what you made, what hit our taste buds.
Yeah.
And which good. I think we can both agree was probably the best thing I ate all day. At least, if not in the last fucking
week.
Super
good. Yeah, it was super good.
If not even longer. It was phenomenal.
It was really good.
What did I put in my face?
So, first off, I want to do a little bit of advertisement for my blog. If you guys are not following, I have my own blog that I started a couple weeks ago. It is called Free Foodie, and the website is freefoodie510.com. And
freefoodie510.com.
Yeah, we'll put a link in.
Yeah, we'll link it up. Yeah. And you can see all your recipes there, correct?
Yes. And so essentially,
what you made today?
Yes, including what I made today is going to be on there hopefully by the end of the day, if not by tomorrow at the very latest.
Cool.
And I do a posting every week. And usually that posting consists of a couple different types of ingredients that I'm going to create a composed dish out of.
Cool.
Sometimes I do a couple different types of, like, snacks. I'm going to eventually be doing things like different, like, condiments that you can have inside your fridge that you can make yourself. Yeah. Things that are everyday, things that you could use. But today what we did was we made fresh ricotta. And a lot of the things that I am trying to do on this blog and trying to help share to the home cook is essentially recipes and techniques that are from a chef that you would see in a restaurant that you can use at home.
Yeah.
And I want to, you know, really stress to people that, you know, and what I stress a lot inside the blog is trying to buy as local as possible. Mm-hmm. Today, pretty much majority of the ingredients that we bought were from a local farmer's market.
Which one? Which farmer's market?
So today we went to the Larchmont Village Farmer's Market.
Oh, Larchmont.
Yes.
Larchmont, yes.
So it is every Sunday.
Larchmont, sorry.
It is every Sunday, I believe, from 8 to 2 p.m.
Well, they'll figure it out. But anyway, like, what's up with the...
So what did you make?
Yeah, what did we buy from the farmer's market?
Or, yeah, so, what did you buy? Because you got some jars here.
Yeah.
I pick this up. So we got a jar here that is literally like a perfect kind of golden ratio cylinder with a wooden cap. I've never seen a jar with a wooden cap.
Yeah, we actually... So we were looking for local honey. Because one of the items that we made today, I made a basic ricotta, very, very simple. And when you're making something like this, like a fresh cheese, you want to be using the best quality milk and cream that you can get. I went and bought Strauss Family Creamery at Whole Foods. Most Whole Foods you can find those at. Or you could go to a farmer's market and you can buy raw milk.
What is ricotta? Because I've seen it in the store.
Yeah. So it's a fresh cheese.
It's a fresh cheese.
Yeah, so there's aged cheese and fresh cheese.
it's not like aged.
Yeah, so there's aged cheese and there's fresh cheeses. Fresh cheeses are going to be ones that using like Milk Way. So that is ricotta, mozzarella, burrata. Oh, those are what you would consider a fresh cheese.
Funky fresh cheese, yo.
And aged cheeses generally go through some form of an aging process.
Right.
But fresh cheeses you can eat immediately.
I found a cave with some cheese in it and I ate it. It got me sick, actually. I shouldn't eat it.
But
this honey, I do want to get back to the honey though. Give a shout out. What do we got here? Bee
so,
green honey?
Yeah, so the
so
honey,
locally sourced honey.
Yeah,
they,
I believe they were from Canoga Park.
The bees are from Africa or?
No.
These are African bees.
I believe they were from, like I said,
they use killer bees for these, right? They use killer bees. It's
the
best honey. It's got the blood of humans coursing through its. Jesus Christ. I'm sorry, everybody.
But, you know,
I do actually wish
that I had, you know, sat and talked to the woman a little bit longer to find out a little bit more, because the website does not have as much information as I would hope to be on it.
Bee Green Honey's fucking
Liz is calling you out. Free Foodie's calling you out. Yeah,
you better get your shit together.
No,
Bee
it's
Green.
Just I think that what they're doing is really awesome, and I think that they've come up with a really amazing product, and I would like for them to give just a little bit more information. So essentially what I got from the website is that Bee Green Honey was founded in 2014 by these two architecture students that had recently graduated, and they wanted to translate their passion for design into a real cause like the... I'm sorry, the dog just farted. That is why we were all laughing. I'm sorry.
You did not need to tell everyone that, but... It's okay. Yeah, that was a dog fart. There was a dog. It just farted.
If you say so.
If you heard it back there in the background, just know we smell it now, and it's brutal.
Blame the dog. No,
but essentially, they wanted to use some form of the ability to use their passion for design to inform people about the decline of the honeybee. So,
which is a nightmare scenario.
Yes, which is really, really
apocalypse.
Bad.
Yeah. You know, I haven't seen that movie yet. The future where fucking the bees died.
I feel like there's...
And everything just starts dying around us.
I feel like there's a documentary about that. Like, there's an entire documentary series that I watched. It's on Netflix about, like, all of these different industries that have to do with food. And one of them was about honey and how, like, most of the honey, like 80 to 85% of the honey or something ridiculous in the U.S. is... not real.
It's corn syrup.
It's corn syrup. It's not real honey, and it's coming from overseas, and they're cutting it with corn syrup to, like, up their profit value, and we ban it. And then what they do is they take that honey, and instead of, like, importing it from China, they'll go from they'll take the honey from China and bring it somewhere where we don't have ban tax, like, on honey yet, and they'll just ship it from that place. So it's still getting into the U.S., and, like, people are paying for, like, 85% corn syrup, 15% bee honey.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, like, if you're not buying honey from either a local source, so, you know, from the farmer's market or a natural food store where it says that it was locally sourced, more than likely you are buying corn syrup.
Which is such a bummer, dude.
It's definitely a bummer. But, you know, these people, so they wanted to create a product that was complementary to design and to help create awareness about the decline in the honeybee. Because I don't know if, you know, everybody knows this, but if the honeybee died out, which they are dying out, and this is a very real risk for us, is that the human race would eventually die. All life on Earth would eventually die because the honeybee is essentially what creates pollination and what gives us the ability to grow.
Yeah, yeah. What's interesting is that, yeah, because the bees are alive, they basically help plants have sex with each other.
Mm-hmm.
Plants are banging with bees.
Vulgar terminology, yes.
Over to another flower and they're splooging back.
But the jar essentially,
and it's crucial.
It's crucial to existence. Yeah, it's crucial to our existence.
The replication of plants, it depends on this process.
So that's why, you know, I would like to say, Bee Green Honey, love your product, love what you're going by. Give us a little bit more information on your website
because how is it happening?
What you're doing is super awesome. I think what you're doing is amazing.
But if you want to spread awareness, have a website that tells me how the bees are dying. Who's
killing
them?
You've been around for 4 years.
You know,
you can
tell me what's going on.
You guys are designers. You can make it happen. I believe in you.
Well, what's cool is I do like their bottle. Like, part of the reason I bought this honey was because we were walking around the farmer's market looking
for local honey. Because I asked, you know, oh, did we have honey at the house? And we knew that we only had corn syrup written honey. So we wanted to buy some locally sourced real honey because we knew that this whole blog posting was going to be centered around using locally sourced products.
Yeah. It's cool. And
the design is dope too.
What is this guy here too?
We have another jar of some local jam. So when we were at the market, one of the fruit purveyors that they had there was also selling jams that were made from their fruits.
Nicholas Family Farms.
Yes, Nicholas Family Farms.
It's in Monson, Orange, California, and they're making. This is a low sugar yellow peach and boysenberry jam. And I gotta say, this was on the sweet. My mouth's watering. This was on the sweet one.
Yeah,
and it was really freaking good.
Well, let's talk about.
Honestly, I was like, "What am I eating?"
Let's talk about what she made, dude, because she took these ingredients.
We should definitely go to that. No one knows what we're talking about. What did we make, Liz?
So we made the fresh ricotta, and that was kind of that essentially was what the blog.
No, at the beginning. We made toast. Two ways.
Yeah. Well, so it starts off with the ricotta, though.
Okay. So I made the ricotta.
Yeah, I made the ricotta, and I wanted to show how you could use the ricotta in two different ways.
Right.
Honestly, you can use ricotta in many, many different ways, but in this standpoint, we were using it to make a toast.
And so how did you make the ricotta? Because that was a question I had.
How I made the ricotta is that you heat up the milk and cream with a little bit of salt.
Heat it up.
And then you take it off the burner, and then you add some lemon juice.
Lemon juice.
And you gently stir it, and it will curdle. You'll be able to.
It curdles.
Yes.
Oh, and that's how.
So that's what the lemon juice is. What the acid, the acidity of the lemon is what curdles.
Heat, low heat. What is this?
You're basically just getting it medium warm. You want it to be hot. Okay. It's essentially just to basically melt the salt into the into the milk. And then, you wanted to get to the proper temp to a high temperature. So the milk and the acid, when it meets, has a chemical reaction where it curdles. That's the other thing that's super cool about cooking is there's lots of chemistry involved. Yeah. And I did very well in high school chemistry. Nice. So I would like to think that that probably translates into my cooking ability.
My mom is she knows like the science behind food. She learned that in order to do food editing.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to understand how to
shout out Alton Brown, genius.
Yeah.
By the way.
Yeah.
Love him. He was another person who on Food Network was a huge inspiration to me his show. I mean, his show Good Eats was amazing. It was super inspiring of where I felt like I was learning about. So, he totally talks about the chemistry. Yeah. Basically, he centers his entire episodes about the science of food.
Yeah.
And I thought that was so, I loved his show. I actually have his entire series on DVD.
That's dope. That's cool.
Well, I gotta say, I've seen Alton Brown a few times, and I've always been like, I did not know that, Mr. Brown.
Yeah.
You just taught me a little trinket of knowledge there.
Yeah. He is a very inspirational man. I made the ricotta, and I wanted to use it in two different aspects. I wanted to make something sweet with it, and I wanted to make something savory with it. And with design, I thought that it was appropriate, because we were going to be talking about design today, to make something that has honestly like been a huge part of like the food styling world and the whole world of design and food is the toast.
Right. Yeah.
We all know that toasts are very, very popular. Yeah. Especially living in Los Angeles. They're very, very popular. It's a huge thing on Instagram. I mean, you constantly are seeing these photos in people's stories on their Instagrams in the daily like recommended
the toast
things is the toast.
It's true. It's interesting because I never really thought much about seeing something being on, like seeing a picture of food and it being on toast. I never thought to like break that into its own category of like you have a piece of toast and you put shit on it.
And that's really like what it is these people like are sandwich. Baking a piece of toast and they're just putting a bunch of shit on it.
Yeah.
And sometimes that shit's not very interesting. Yeah. I mean,
stuck at like butter. I was like, damn, dude, this toast with butter is so good.
There's the whole...
I can't figure out how to make this better.
There was the whole unicorn toast fad for a while of where, this woman is literally just mixing food coloring into a bunch of cream cheese and spreading it in different ways on a piece of toast and putting glitter and sprinkles and stuff like that.
Photo opportunity, though.
And she's super famous for it.
Yeah. Well, because she photographs doing well.
Is putting cream cheese on some toast. My point with this is that you can make a toast super beautiful and super interesting in two different ways, more than two different ways. Yeah. This is just two ways that I decided to do today.
Like the two that we made, that you made, were super, even though one's sweet and one's savory, they felt like they belonged in the same family. Like genre-wise, they felt like they were related, you know what I mean?
Yeah, 100%.
Like, I could have easily seen, like, going to a restaurant and being like, you know what? I'm gonna have this savory, toast, and then this savory toast comes with the sweet toast at the end. You know what I mean?
Yeah, you could do different toasts. That would be a great restaurant.
Yeah, people like
would
those
love
are.
I would love that. Paired, I would, like, I'll take
like you
those
get a
toasts,
paired
please.
Together.
Yeah.
From the
I
chef
think there is a restaurant in Los Angeles called Toast.
Really?
But they don't do that.
We should look. Yeah. I don't think they do that.
They don't
but,
do that. They
yeah,
should.
That's a
that was a huge
idea.
Lost opportunity right there, Toast.
Yeah, there is. There's also a POS system called Toast. I did not know that.
Oh, it's my favorite POS system.
Oh, really?
Shout out to Toast. Yeah.
I have not used them.
Me either. I just like that it's called Toast,
I have used many different POS systems in my career. Actually, pretty much every single restaurant that I have worked at has used a different POS system, which is super annoying because every single time I start a job at a new restaurant, I have to learn a new fucking system. But most of the time, they're pretty easy to figure out.
Hasn't Square kind of taken the game on that front now?
What is it?
Square?
No, so Square is a POS system that's purely through your phone, though. That's for like food trucks and stuff.
That's not true.
No, they're expanding.
They're into iPad. Like they have a whole.
I don't agree using iPads for POS systems, though. There's a reason why a lot of these POS systems have an entire computer that's built specifically for that, because you're using so much information and there's so many different algorithms and shit
they're trying to create all of it.
Yeah, because I've worked for a restaurant that had a POS system that was iPad based, and we continuously had problems with the iPads crashing.
Right.
Because they could not handle the processing power that you needed for the system. And it was very frustrating because, I mean, it would crash, and then we would be like, well, how do we charge people?
Yeah.
We wouldn't get tickets for things. It would cause a lot of headaches and a lot of mess. Now, this was granted 4 years ago. Yeah. So hopefully they've changed.
That's the thing. 4 years ago, Square was just probably a phone-based thing or iPad-based thing, like what you're thinking about. And then more recently, they sell packages now, I'm pretty sure, to restaurants. And if you own a restaurant, you can get a package, and it will come with all the devices you need. They're all loaded
up. That's usually was the same thing with the I believe. God, what's it?
They just have reduced costs, basically. Because
butter. I'm trying to remember the iPad based POS system that I used, but I don't remember what it was. Back to toast.
Yeah, back to toast. So anyway, the cool thing is we had two different toasts. We had a sweet and a savory. So I think we should start with what I saw you kind of do, which was
Got to watch me make them. So.
Yeah, so we got to watch you make it, and you were spreading the ricotta on the toast in a very specific way.
Yes.
Yeah, there was, and this was actually, well, before that, you were mixing things into the ricotta, right?
Yeah, so basically I took the base ricotta. So I made the base ricotta.
No flavors added, really. Right?
And then I split it up and I added the different flavor components that I wanted to each ricotta. So for the savory one, I basically decided to keep it really simple, actually. I just added some salt and some pepper. And a little bit of olive oil.
Okay.
And that was it.
Was there lemon in it? There was no lemon.
There was lemon zest.
Lemon zest. Okay, yeah, because I tasted that. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, I
did add lemon zest to the savory one. And you can add a bunch of different stuff. If you want to change the savory components, you could add herbs. You could add garlic. You can add all different kinds of things that you want to the savory ricotta to create a savory flavor.
We got a little dog. We got a little dog situation here. He needs a little loving, so we're gonna handle that. It's fine. You know, things happen. Life happens.
Yeah.
Nothing's perfect except for your toast, which was pretty goddamn close.
And then for the sweet one, I added again a little bit more salt and some of this locally sourced honey that we bought because it was, you know, provide a nice sweet component to it.
Yeah.
I don't like to use sugar. So that's one of the reasons why I wanted to use honey. I have been trying to reduce my sugar intake recently. And it's been helping a lot with my overall like health and happiness and helping me sleep and get to sleep a lot more easily.
Yeah.
So
I'm pretty sure sugar is a poison.
Yeah.
And I don't mean this, you know, if you like sugar, great. I had a bunch of sugar the other night. I went to Candytopia, which is this weird. It's like being at Willy Wonka's Chocolate Factory. But I felt terrible.
You feel like hungover.
Yeah, sugar hangover, for sure.
And it's one of those things where, like, you could have not drank at all.
Yeah.
But you had a bunch of sugar, and you feel like shit the next day.
Yeah, sugar messes you up. It messes you up. So not a lot of sugar, but you did add some honey, which has sugar, but
yes,
you know, just a little dab of honey. It wasn't overly sweet, I liked.
Actually. I really added
your sweet
just a tiny bit because, I mean, especially because this is actual real honey. Real honey is very sweet. It's going to have a very sweet flavor to it. So, and this is actually, we got a raspberry honey. And we got that because we were using raspberries in the toast as well.
No.
So from there, I spread the ricotta on the toast And I made sure. Hold on.
We're going to take a pause here. Sorry, guys. The dog really needs love, and we got to handle it. All right. We'll be right back. All right. The dog's been put down.
Oh, my God.
It's fine. It won't be making any more noises.
Don't move them. You're not supposed to move them.
Oh, sorry. Jake, stop playing with the table dicks, man.
I'm not supposed to move them?
No. He's kept them that way forever.
Since like his last orgy, bro.
They were in that order when he bought the bowl.
There's a bowl of dicks on the table.
Like he basically
the bowl has phalluses carved from stone.
I have a picture.
Okay, let's look at the picture.
Greg has moved the phallus.
Shut up, bro. Don't fucking
Greg has moved the phallus, and now the phalluses are out of alignment.
The phalluses are out of alignment, Greg.
Fuck, I feel
now
bad.
Now one of them's pointing right at me, dude.
Wait, was it not before?
No, I don't know. I don't remember. Dude. I wasn't looking at the dicks, man. I wasn't looking to touch dicks, bro.
It was like that.
Shit.
All right. So, but we were talking about spreading the ricotta on the bread in a very particular fashion.
Yeah. So, I essentially want you, when you're making a toast like this, especially if you're going to be putting something like a cheese or a spread at all, also when you're making a sandwich, I mean, a hamburger for that matter, whenever you're putting some type of a spread mm-hmm. on a piece of bread,
when you're spreading on bread,
you should be making sure that. It is hitting every edge of the piece of bread. You want to, because you essentially want to be thinking about how you're going to be eating it. You want.
I got a little rhyme. I got a little rhyme for you. When you spread on the bread, you got to get to the edge.
But you,
there you go.
Basically, you want to think about it how every single time somebody takes a bite of it, you want them to get that flavor.
Yeah, that's the. And also, I think it acts as like a glue, you know, because when you're eating toast, shit is falling off.
Yeah.
And if you got the glue on every corner, your contents are sticking to the toast. So get spread it nice even. You were also rubbing like garlic on the bread or something?
Yeah, so the savory one, what I did before I put the ricotta on it, I made what you call pan con tomate. This is a traditional Spanish way of serving toast, where you toast the bread and you rub it with a raw garlic clove and then the end of a tomato.
Mm.
So you save all the ends of your tomatoes after you slice them and you rub
the bread
with the tomato.
And the garlic. That does something?
Oh.
Yeah.
Brings
that does something.
Out wonderful, that's savory
a cool trick.
Flavors.
Yeah.
It really adds another flavor component to the dish. Mm. And one of the things, like especially with doing these toasts, that I really like to stress upon is that you're building these flavors on top of each other. I mean, every single time you're making a layer, you want to be sure it's seasoned. This is one thing that a lot of people don't realize. And one of the reasons why so many people find food that's made in a restaurant for them so much better than what they would at home is because they're not seasoning their food enough.
Yeah, seasoning.
Every single time you put a layer on your toast, you should be seasoning that component.
Well, you know what's interesting is we've been told, you know, that I know that collectively my family was told, like, oh, you have a risk for heart disease, so you shouldn't have salt. You shouldn't have pepper. Nobody said pepper, but
fucking lie. Though,
the end of the day, I think, and you know, we're doing it right now with sugar. I was like, sugar is poison. Like, okay, well, it is poison, but don't candy. Candy is bad. Maybe a little sugar is okay. Same with a little bit of salt's okay. Imagine if we ate salt bricks. Bricks of salt, like we do candy.
I actually don't think salt is nearly as bad for you as we originally thought it was.
Yeah,
but
you actually
that much salt.
Yeah, so you actually need to have salt in your diet. There's a lot of
too much of anything is not
that's
good
the
for you. But at the same time, like I think the propaganda has been sold to us as though like saturated fats and salt were the cause of heart disease, and that's not true.
Right,
that's a big fucking lie. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it turns out it's probably more. A lot of diseases can be attributed, I think, to, like, too much of one thing.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Think,
and also, the thing is that as humans, we need to have variety balance in our diets. Balance. And that's one of the things that, you know, I really, I don't like the idea of, I like the idea of like the meal prep service of, you know, creating a meal plan for yourself and especially making it easier for yourself throughout the week.
Yeah.
But I don't like the idea of every single week you're eating the same thing every day. Like, yeah, you shouldn't, yeah, that's not healthy for your body.
Yeah.
Well, I think that's also cool because that's what you're doing with your site. Your site is like this, everything that you post on there is like different. It's not the same shit every day. Like, you might do toast one week, and then the next week you might do chia pudding, which is, you know, also super fucking good. It's just like there's a variety of things.
And another thing, Liz, another thing I would ask you to do, Liz, you don't have to, but one thing that would be dope, maybe you do this already, is to think of, like, if I'm going to buy all these ingredients to make this thing, how else can I use those ingredients? Or the leftovers of those ingredients, you know? Like, like your ricotta, if you like, yo, make ricotta. Now you have ricotta. Now you can do these other things.
It's real. You know what I mean? Yeah. You're bringing the reality of it into the home, which is kind of cool. Instead of just like, this is for this one dish, now you got to go to the grocery store.
And you don't have to do it all the time, but it definitely is attractive.
And you know what's funny? I actually recently had somebody reach out to me on Instagram asking me about how much I thought that I spent every single week, like, on my diet, because I have been trying to focus more on like a high fat, high calorie diet because I've been working out a lot.
Yeah.
And you know, it was one of those things where like, I'd never really quite thought about it, but you know, when I was asked about it, you know, I told her, I was like, you know, when I go grocery shopping, I think about how I can use these ingredients in multiple different ways.
Yeah.
So I go grocery shopping and I buy, you know, a couple heads of broccoli. Oh, I can have this tonight steamed, or, you know, later this week I could have it roasted, or I could have it raw in a pasta salad in a couple of days. You know, I always try and buy my ingredients thinking in a way of how I can use them in multiple different ways.
It's realistic. It's not like you're not thinking of this. It's like, I'm going to make this website for one dish.
And then,
you know, it's and eat the rest of the food, right? Like, you're still gonna have food to be able to, like, keep designing new dishes.
I think that's actually, you know, a good point. It's like, learn, you know, that would be a good thing for everyone to learn, is to, like, when you're at the grocery store, like, try to understand how, maybe, and that's something I've done a few times where I'll just Google, like, yo, how do I use this?
Yeah.
Do that more often, you know? Yeah. To at least learn the basics.
For sure.
And it's also, it's just going to be one of those things where you're going to be less likely to be throwing away stuff. The restaurant industry is probably one of the most, it as much as I love it, is incredibly wasteful. I can't tell you how much food gets thrown away at restaurants. It's horrifying. And actually, if you guys don't listen to it, you should definitely also listen to the Munchies podcast. They have done an interview with this chef in Denmark, I believe, in Copenhagen, who has created a fully sustainable restaurant.
That's pretty
so
cool.
They,
what's it called? Munchies?
It's called the Munchies podcast.
Munchies.
Yeah, it's like a Viceland.
It's a product of Viceland, you know,
you're saying there's a sustainable restaurant?
Yeah, there's this restaurant in Copenhagen, Denmark, where it's fully sustainable. So sustainable basically means that they are creating zero waste.
Yeah.
Mm.
So if you're fully sustainable, you're creating zero waste. So that means that they're using pretty much everything that they bring in, down to fish bones, you know? So they are not producing any form of waste. So they are not throwing out anything. So they're eating.
What do you
do with
fish bones?
You can make stock.
You make stock. Okay. So you get but then you do throw something away, but it's.
But you can also compost it.
You can compost it and then grow new things.
That's cool. Yeah.
Exactly.
And then you never.
They have a garden there. Yeah. Like, it's really, really, really interesting. I do not remember the name of the restaurant, but definitely just check out the podcast, listen through it. I think it's in the first season. You'll figure it out. You should just listen to the podcast in general because it's very interesting, especially if you're interested in food.
I'm fascinated by that. Yeah. No, that's super cool.
Let's talk about the avocado toast. Like, Let's go through it.
Yeah. So the avocado toast, I got the bread from Bread Bar at the Larchmont Village Farmers Market this morning. We walked over to the Larchmont Village Farmers Market. And it's a great farmer's market if you haven't been to it. Other farmer's markets here in Los Angeles that I love going to are the Wednesday Santa Monica Farmer's Market, which is over at the 3rd Street Promenade. I also enjoy the Plummer Park Farmer's Market, which is in West Hollywood. It is on Mondays from 8 a.m. to 1 p.m., I believe. I used to live right down the street. There's the Hollywood Farmers Market on Sundays as well. That is from 8 a.m. to 1:30 p.m.
Look up your local farmer's market.
Yeah.
up your local farmer's market. Because not everybody's in L.A.
Yeah. So, but if you're in Los Angeles, there's tons of farmer's markets. More than likely, wherever you live, they have a farmer's market or somewhere you can get whole products.
Yeah.
And
that's probably one of the key secrets here.
It's or go to your local bakery. You can go to your local bakery as well and get fresh bread. But the key is to use good, fresh bread because the entire point of this toast is the bread.
What kind of bread did we use?
So we got a whole grain bread that is like a rustic style loaf.
Mm-hmm.
And it's got a nice, hard, crusty exterior, but it's nice and spongy. It has a little bit of sourness and wheatiness in the center. For my toast, I like to do a nice, I would say probably 3/4 inch thick.
Yeah.
Slice. I like a nice thick toast. I like to feel the toast. You don't want it to be too thick, obviously, unless you're using a softer bread like brioche.
Don't be an inch, but get close. Yeah.
But you also don't want it to be like, I hate it when I go to a restaurant and I get a toast and it's this super thin, like wimpy piece of bread.
Oh, yeah.
And especially also if they haven't toasted it properly.
I've smashed tables. I kicked someone in the head when I saw that one time.
The other thing is you got to toast your bread properly.
I blacked out and I woke up in an alleyway covered in blood, man.
Yeah.
Don't do it. And
leftover toast.
Don't fuck with my toast.
But you want that nice, like, golden brown toastiness where it's obviously not burnt, but you want a nice golden brown toastiness where it's got a nice crisp on the outside. So with the avocado toast, we rubbed it with garlic. We rubbed it with the tomato and did the pan con tomate.
Spread the
salt and pepper ricotta on top. And then I took the avocado and I sliced it very, very, very thinly.
Mm-hmm.
And then basically, if you want to make it look really nice, so this goes to the design component of this.
Yeah.
If you want to make it really nice.
How do you make your avocado look nice?
You have your avocado, and also be careful not to give yourself avocado hand. Did you guys actually know that avocado hand was one of the like highest leading like things like for, that people came into the hospital for in 2017?
What is avocado hand?
It's where when you're having your avocado and you hit your knife on the seed to pull out the seed, people have been cutting their hands.
Oh.
Well, they're missing the pit.
Yeah.
Oh, I do it differently. Mm-hmm. I take the tip of the knife and I stick it in and then I twist it out.
Oh.
I always
do the chop.
No,
I do the
chop.
Chop
seems dangerous.
But
dude,
the points. Jabbing it with 2 points seems way more dangerous.
No, because you slowly put it in.
You can also possibly break the tip off of your knife.
Oh, yeah, I definitely fucked up 2 knives.
Yeah.
But I figured, fuck it, it's a knife, it's not my hand, you know? So.
I buy $200, $300 knives, so
don't
that's
use
a different story for me.
Use a terrible knife, a dull knife if possible, you know?
But then you're going to scoop, so you can very, if you take a spoon, you can very gently push the side of the skin away from the flesh of the avocado.
Yeah.
So you can basically
scoop
out the half of the avocado in a perfect, like, beautiful little half moon of the avocado.
Yeah.
You're going to put it on your cutting board, use a very, very sharp knife, and slice as straight as you can. Nice thin slices.
Mm.
And then you're going to take the flat side of your knife and gently press it where you're going to be moving the knife against the avocado to the direction of where you want it to fall.
Mm. So it kind of fans
out. Yeah, exactly.
The avocado fans out.
Yeah.
That's
cool. It fans out.
I didn't see you do that. I'm kind of bummed. Next time you show me.
I can definitely show you how to do that.
I missed that too, because I've always had problems like, usually when I cut the avocado and take the pit out, I'll cut like inside the skin. I'll slice it.
Yeah,
in
when
the
I make
skin.
Guacamole, that's
that's
what I'll
do.
Yeah,
yeah.
I don't usually take it. Yeah, yeah, I don't usually take it halfway out. So because I've noticed that it's difficult to like get it out of the skin like in a perfect half dome shape.
Yeah,
you know?
No.
If you're using a very shape. A proper like a perfectly ripe avocado, which today we were very lucky and got some pretty damn perfectly ripe avocados from the farmer's market.
Yeah, they were delicious.
They,
I mean, every component was delicious. Liz.
Yeah,
yeah, it was
and
interesting.
Then the ones you chose and how you put it together was truly amazing. So I highly recommend going to your website.
Yeah,
and, like trying
Free
this out yourself.
510.
Free foodie
510. Well, what's cool? What's cool about the whole thing that we ate was that like the toast had like she's talking about layering, you know, and like I could taste the layering. Like there was a. So when the first bite, like the first chew of that first bite, ends up being like very fatty and like creamy,
well,
but then
it
gets like
and ricotta,
avocado, and then the ricotta layered,
and then
on
top
of that was salt, pepper, like olive oil,
yeah,
and then like you get the flavor of the crispiness and the crunchiness of the toast at the bottom. So like each. Like,
what was above that? There was more.
So there was tomatoes, which I marinated in olive oil, lemon juice, salt, and pepper, and put those on top of the seasoned avocado.
Yeah.
And then I took some very thinly sliced radishes and put those on top of that, as well as parsley leaves. Finished that all off with salt and pepper, some lemon zest, and a drizzle of olive oil on top of that.
Yeah.
The whole thing is that like when you're creating something like this, you always want to think about the layers and think about every single thing needs to be seasoned and everything needs to have its own way to stand out.
Yeah. Well,
but
I
you
can
want
taste
it,
that.
Yeah, and you want everybody to be able to, you want people to be able to taste each component, but you also want all of those components to work together. Because if they don't work together, then it's just going to be this big pile of a mess of these different flavors that are competing against each other.
Yeah. And I could taste the design. You know what I mean? Like you could tell that these things were meant to be put together and they were precisely chosen and like it articulated through in the flavor profile. It was good. It was
very
like
very fucking good.
A sort of like creaminess with salty, and then on
really
the
good.
End, the aftertaste was cool too because
y'all
it was
missing
like...
out.
Well, you can check out her site; it's gonna be up there and make it yourself. But I noticed that at the very end, like the radish did something that I did like kind of didn't expect. Like the radish and the parsley had this
like
super
earthy, crispy,
crispy fresh flavor, which
man.
Was cool.
Felt like just crispy fresh dirt.
Yeah, so
and
one
it was good. I liked it. Not
one
a bad
thing I
thing.
Always really like
Radishes
to do in my cooking, and I think a lot of home cooks don't think about, is adding fresh herbs to their dishes.
Yeah.
A lot of people don't buy herbs, and I really highly recommend buying
herbs.
And
you buy those at the farmer's market?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Definitely. I definitely say look for them at your farmer's market because they're going to be really cheap at the farmer's market. I mean,
is
you
it
could
hard
get a
to grow
huge,
your own herbs?
It's super easy to grow your own herbs,
is
actually.
It?
Especially more of your like woody herbs, like the woodstem herbs, like thyme and rosemary. I mean, rosemary is basically grows like a weed. A lot of people have it in their front yards.
Yeah.
You can find it on the street in Los Angeles.
That street Mary.
I mean, it's
street Mary rosemary.
Pretty easy to find the stuff. For the most part, herbs are really easy to grow. I mean, they have all different. You can buy like a little hydroponic herb set on Amazon. I mean, fresh herbs are very easy to come by. They're very inexpensive. You can get, most places sell them for $1 a bunch.
Yeah.
And you can use them for a lot of things, especially if you're using things like parsley, cilantro. I do know there are people out there that are soap tasters of cilantro. I am not a soap taster personally. I have known many people who are soap tasters.
I have a question, Liz.
Yeah.
Okay. It was out the other night with some friends of my girlfriend's, and they were talking about cucumbers tasting too strong.
What does that mean?
They were like, I don't like cucumbers. It's too strong of a taste.
Really?
And I was like, what? I was like, I don't taste shit. It's crunchy water. It's crunchy water. What do you taste? They're like, you have definite taste. Definite taste.
Oh, man.
So and I was like,
sound
I wonder
like
if
horrible
they're...
people.
No. They were good people. They were good people.
I
was like, yo. I was like, yo, I'm pretty sure there's a genetic. There could be another, like, one of these cilantro scenarios.
So that to me sounds like a.
I'm just proposing it.
Could
I'm just. Because why else would you be such a douchebag about. cucumbers.
You know, because I have an elevated palate, and really, you know, I noticed that, like, during my meals, they're flexing their palate.
They were
flexing. Yeah, dude. That totally sounds like...
That's bullshit. It didn't come off like that. I engaged them on it, and I was like, yo, that doesn't make sense.
Yeah, because that's...
And they stuck to their guns.
Because you're not egotistical, and these people sound horrible, egotistical... Like,
all right.
Greg doesn't like you.
I don't like you. I don't like you.
He doesn't like you, non-cucumber eaters.
Yeah, if you don't like cucumbers, I hate you.
This is actually very interesting. And this is something that I have actually noticed with certain breeds of cucumbers. There's been different breeds of cucumbers. I don't know if many people knew that, but there's English cucumbers, there's domestic cucumbers.
I know there's Persian
cucumbers.
I've had friends that tell me, no, this is horrible. It's not Persian.
Where is the Persian?
Where is
cucumber?
Is that the French?
I am a French Iranian.
You are the Frenchest Iranian I've ever heard speak.
Where is my Persian cucumber? My Parisian cucumber.
But so I looked it up, and cucumbers do actually have a chemical component in them called PTC, and
PTC
is something
will fuck you up.
That where people have a certain gene where they will taste either very bitter or virtually tasteless, and it's a genetic makeup, depends on the genetic makeup of the taster.
What's the percentage of people that have it?
Boom! I knew it, because they were freaking convinced it was disgusting, and I was like, I don't taste a goddamn thing! Blew my
That's
mind.
The thing is, I feel that
it
way.
Blew my mind.
I feel that way about watermelon.
Watermelon.
See, watermelon to me tastes like watery, like
you don't taste the melon.
Foam. It tastes like foam. I don't taste, but I taste other. I taste other like melon, like regular, you know, green or whatever.
Yeah.
Melon. I can taste that. That has a flavor, but like watermelon to me doesn't have a flavor.
Fascinating, dude.
But cucumber has a flavor, and it's not an overpowering flavor for me. It tastes like
it's very subtle.
It's crisp but subtle. It's like natural.
Yeah, I agree.
So this is actually interesting, and actually, you know, I have, as I was thinking about this, and I didn't really think about it too much at the time, but when you brought it up of like the bitter tasting of a cucumber, a way that you can get rid of that if you do have that bitter taste is by getting rid of the skin, just an FYI.
Oh.
The skin is where that flavor component is most predominant.
Skin and cucumber.
That's why a lot of people, if you eat Persian cucumbers, so Persian cucumbers have a very thin outer layer, and they're generally seedless, so they're not going to have that bitter component.
Wow.
So if you do taste that bitter component, I do recommend trying Persian cucumbers.
Science!
But this is saying that it can also contribute to people who smoke. And now that I thought about it, when I used to smoke cigarettes, I have not smoked cigarettes for almost a year and a half now.
Yeah.
Good for you. When I did, thank you. But when I did smoke them, I do remember finding that the skin of cucumbers was very bitter. But now I do not.
Weird. I don't remember like ever at any point ever feeling like cucumbers.
I haven't shifted on my stance on cucumbers.
I mean, it just could also come down to
crunchy water.
Your genetic makeup.
But I really think
I've got
that
good
I think...
genetics. That's true.
Me too, dude. We can eat cucumbers.
Fuck yeah. Those other people that hate cucumbers, that's just bad genetics right
you
there.
Know?
That's just bad genes. Sorry. You're your own worst punishment. Complain about it all you want.
You should have been a mixed breed, bro.
Yeah, now
all that inbreeding fucked you up.
All
you taste is bitter cucumbers.
That inbreeding fucked you up.
But so, I mean, that's fairly interesting. there is definitely like the interesting thing about how everybody's taste is always different, and I always like to kind of stress that about it, especially if you have somebody. You know, it's always a bummer whenever you have somebody tell you that they didn't like something that you made. Like, especially being a chef, that happens.
But we also talked about this last week. We were talking about when things taste good versus when things are, like, subjective.
Right.
Like, when things are good subjectively.
Mm-hmm.
And I think everybody understands when something is good. for the most part. I feel like there's always going to be a few outliers where things don't. But things may not taste
with
great.
With our eyes, right? It's like there's only so many colors, right? But with cooking, you have like way more flavors. I feel like our colors are basically this RGB. You know, that's it. Red, green, blue. That's what the rods in our eyes that detect color. That's it, dude.
No,
it's a part of a spectrum.
No, so I can prove this. The reason I believe this, is not just because I believe that like everybody generally likes the same things. That's not true. Like
I'm saying, there's people, less combinations with visual stuff. With cooking, it's almost like there's more possible
there areas are definitely
for a difference of opinion.
I feel like there are, that may be true, but I still think for the most part, when something tastes good, like 99% of people know when it tastes good and think it tastes good, because we've talked about this before, where like our genetic makeup is not that dissimilar from each other. Like most people are almost exactly the same. You know what I mean?
That's true.
We share a lot, and we have very little variation.
Have a lot of variation, though, but it's all based on a very small part of our genetics, you know?
What's super, super minute, you know what I mean?
And we have people that can't taste cucumbers right. These are all genetic.
But I also think, like, even down to, like, a monetary level, people will go to certain restaurants and enjoy that meal. Because
they'll all enjoy it.
You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, restaurants are doing well for a reason. They do well for a reason. Because most of the people find the food good. You know what I mean?
No, and I think that's why we still have these, like, cheap, fast food joints. I mean, is because
I think everybody, for the most part, like,
you gotta eat.
Most people think that
people put up with a
good.
Lot, you know? So, really, to offer a really good experience, is you just gotta care. You know,
agree, but what I'm saying is that like we have this basic like understanding. I feel like it's almost universal that people find a certain flavor profile
good.
Palatable and good and like desirable. You know what I mean? That's why most people enjoy salt. That's why most people enjoy sugar. Yeah. Like even if you don't like want to eat it because it's bad for you, and you understand
most of us
understand that it tastes good, you know? So
And I think one thing about your dish, Liz, was the balance between all these different flavors, and kind of that's one thing I think when you've cooked for me a few times now, like, and I've looked at your recipes, that you know, you're good at balancing out a lot of different flavors. So I think that it would be, you know, I think I said this, I'd pay for it. I mean, it was good.
It was really good. Let's talk about the sweet one. Sweet toast was really good too.
Yeah, that was delicious.
Yeah so with the sweet one, you know, we already talked about how I seasoned the ricotta with a little bit of honey. So I spread that just on straight toast. I didn't rub that with anything. You know, you're not wanting to put garlic on a sweet toast. So I didn't rub that toast with anything, but I did use the same bread.
Unless you're psycho.
Sorry.
I did use the same bread because, like I said, we got this really fantastic bread from the farmer's market from Bread Bar. And so I spread the sweetened ricotta all over the toast, making sure that it was all to the edges. And then I put this jam that we got from the farmer's market. So we got a yellow peach and boysenberry jam from Nicholas Family Farms. We already talked about them. Okay. Gave a little information about them. They do a very low sugar jam. And pretty much the ingredients, as it's listed here on the jar, it's yellow peaches, boysenberries, sugar, pectin, and lemon juice. And that's it.
Wow.
That's great. I mean, that's like...
What is pectin?
Pectin is actually an ingredient that is it's derived from apples, it's something that can help. It's a thickening agent.
Okay.
Similar to
apple thickener.
Yeah. So
come
it's
buy
natural,
my apple thickener.
It's a natural plant-based thickener.
Yeah.
Essentially, and it's actually one of the key components in apples. I don't know if you've ever tried this, but when you're nauseous, if you try eating an apple, it oftentimes helps relieve your nausea. Mm. And the reason for that is because of the pectin in it.
Wow. I saw
pectin a day keeps your nausea away.
Wow. Yeah. When I used to drink a lot.
Alex is now the spokesman.
When I first started cooking and I drank quite a bit, pretty much every single morning I would have a breakfast of Gatorade and an apple.
Okay. All right. Nice.
Sounds
weird.
It's Sunny in Philadelphia episode where Mac tells Dennis that they have a breakup and they get back together, and Mac is telling Dennis, like, what have you been doing since we've not been hanging out or whatever, and he's like, I ate an apple. I smoked
with the skin on
it. Yeah, I ate an apple with the skin on it. And Mac tells him, "You smoke some cigarettes, and that'll tamp it down. It'll save your life." So I heard that's the cure. A few cigarettes,
a pack of cigarettes for
an apple skin.
You'll never know you're sick.
Don't smoke cigarettes; they're bad for you.
Yeah, dude.
No, they're not.
Yeah. Well, pretty soon they won't be.
But anyways, and so on top of the ricotta, I put this wonderful yellow peach and boysenberry jam. And the thing that was really nice about this is that it had a really great texture to it. Mm. They cut like nice big chunks of the peaches, which I really liked. And I like
it wasn't super pureed.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I really like you got the texture of the fruit, and it wasn't very sweet, which is really nice because sugar is not good for you. Yeah.
Plus, it's already naturally sweet from
the
fruit.
You're getting the natural sugars. Yeah, you get the natural sugars from the berries. Just that little bit of sugar that they're adding to it, as well as the lemon juice, has helped bringing out that natural sweetness.
Yeah.
Essentially, like what I did with the berries, which is the next component that we're going to talk about. So we got some great berries from a farm at the farmer's market. We got blackberries, raspberries, and blueberries. And I took them and put them into wash them. Always wash all of your produce, especially if you're getting it from the farmer's market. Mm-hmm.
Why?
What's wrong with it?
There's nothing wrong with it, but you're just basically going to be washing any type of dirt, any type of impurities that could be on it.
Got to wash the pee-pee off your veggies.
You just wash any produce that you buy that you're going to be putting into your body. Even if it says that it was already washed.
I mean,
there's urine on everyone's hands.
Well,
all right,
it's sterile.
Watch it off.
It's sterile, so what's the problem?
Oh, okay. Don't wash your veggies then, bro.
But I took each one of these berries and put them in a bowl, and each one of them I added about a tablespoon's worth of lemon juice and a teaspoon's worth of sugar. And so what this does is the acid and the sugar helps bring out the natural sweetness and flavors of each of the berries.
Mm. So weird that you would
think
you're
just adding, you're elevating like the contrast
within
the fruit.
Yeah,
like,
exactly.
By adding the components in that will boost it.
Yes.
Trippy, dude.
And all you need to do is let them sit out at room temperature for 5 to 10 minutes.
Yeah.
They'll start naturally creating their own kind of juice,
I guess you could say. Yeah.
I love doing it to strawberries. I mean, it
sounds so good. My mouth's watering.
I saw you adding like salt to it too.
Yes.
You know,
salt is a key ingredient to anything sweet. It's a key ingredient in cooking no matter what. A lot of people think that you shouldn't add salt to something that's sweet, but salt actually brings out the natural sweetness in dishes.
Yeah.
So add
like
salt
to chocolate
your
chip cookies, throw a little salt in there.
Yep.
That's true, yeah. We made chocolate chip cookies and we did put salt.
You make it some pancakes? Throw a little salt in there.
Yeah. I mean, as you will notice, if you look up pretty much any type of a baking recipe, even if you buy like a box mix at the grocery store, there's going to be either salt already in there or they're going to be telling you to add salt.
Yeah. And we sweetened it too with the honey, right? Like that was part of the sweetness along with the like jam and
yes. So I actually, after I put the berries on, I did finish it with a little bit more of the honey. I didn't add the honey to the actual berries themselves when I was macerating them, but I did finish the entire toast with a nice drizzle of this honey that we bought from Bee Green. Then I garnished it as well with some edible flowers and some fresh picked mint.
The mint was really good. Yeah. That was like a really good aftertaste.
Yeah. So the mint is going to bring in that fresh component that is a little bit different from the fresh berries. So you're getting all those sweet components from the ricotta, from the jam, from the raspberries, the blueberries and blackberries, and from the honey. But the mint is what's bringing in that fresh component, all which I think is really important.
So I have a question. I have a question for you. How do we make it better? What do you want to do better, different?
Yeah, because what ever we had it? Was amazing. So, like, now that you've had it, you've made it, you've had time to...
I don't think I would change a goddamn thing.
I don't know. I actually do think that there is something that I would change. Okay. I would add some type of nut.
Oh.
Possibly candied, maybe not, maybe just
so after you post this, you could be like, hey motherfuckers, try some nuts. And see what people
that's
come
a
up
good
with
idea.
Maybe like some hazelnuts or maybe some almonds, or even there's this great keto granola that I have used in one of my blog postings in the past that is also available.
Is that
at the
egg white one?
Yes.
Damn, that was good.
That is also available at the Larch Village Farmer's Market.
Yeah, they're there at the
Larch It is called Nora's Food Company. Holy shit. If you are trying to be grain-free and gluten-free, try this shit out. She ships worldwide.
Yeah,
it was really
good. Google it. I believe her website is just norrisfoodcompany.com.
We'll post a link.
We'll post a link. It is so good.
Yeah.
It is toasted coconut. It does have tree nuts, so if you have a tree nut allergy, obviously don't try it. It's got dried currants. And what she does is she binds it with egg white. So it is not vegan, but she binds it with egg white. And it creates a super crunchy, like, awesome texture. Yeah, and yes, you do get that nice crunchiness from the toast, but I feel like having that top layer component of crunchiness.
It's got a great flavor, too, though. Like, the flavor of it is, like,
and you'll get that nut. You'll get a nuttiness from it, too.
It's like a nut. It's a lot like eating nuts. Yeah,
the interesting thing that I thought about it is that sometimes I feel like I have a lot of friends who feel like coconut is kind of an overpowering, like, flavor, and that's why they don't like the texture and the flavor of coconut.
Yeah.
You know? And
this is not overpowering.
This is not overpowering. No. This was not like...
You could even tell that it's coconut.
You could really eat it and be like, there's coconut in this? You know?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah. Oh, yeah.
So it's like, it's... And if you're looking for it, you can taste it because it's like a subtle, like, baked
flavor. It was not strong.
It wasn't
really good.
Know.
Yeah.
Well, and that, part of that, too, could be... I think a lot of people that put coconut flavor on something, like, it's coconut flavor.
Yeah.
You know, I think when you eat an actual coconut, it's not that strong. I've eaten one. Like,
But you've also had shaved coconut.
Shaved coconut, I think they enhance the flavor with something. Maybe.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, a lot of times when people are having, when they think about coconut, they're thinking about Mounds bars and almond bars, and that's, like, that super, like, processed, sickly sweet, been processed with corn syrup, and it's really, really sugary and not
so good for your veins and arteries.
I hated coconut for years growing up because I had it in my head that all coconut tasted like Mounds bars, and I hated Mounds bars.
I had a fascinating thing happen in Hawaii that culinarily wise I think has not been exploited yet, probably because it's impossible, but if you cut open a coconut at the right time, which I just got lucky and happened to do this, the liquid inside starts turning into a nut or like a hard shape or something. It like hardens. And there's this moment where it's like cotton candy on the inside of a coconut.
Weird.
And
it's almost like a jelly. I've had it where it's almost like a jelly.
No, this was like... a network of cotton candy, basically.
What?
And it only happens at like this very particular moment, and then it hardens into the the
Do they sell? Is there someone that sells that?
No, because you don't know when that moment is.
Yeah. So and they haven't growth. Figured it's out just how a to guessing tell. Game.
No one's figured out how to tell when it is.
Oh, that's awesome, huh. Dude.
And if you could just chop it open, and there it was. I'm like, where the fuck's my liquid, bro?
Yeah, if you could. Oh man, it for anybody out there that could figure that out, that's like a fucking $1 million.
Or maybe I just ate a rancid one and they were fucking with me. But
coconut cotton candy,
it tasted good. I liked it. Natural. You're lucky, but I was also like, motherfucker, I wanted liquid. You know, yeah. I was thirsty.
Yeah.
And I got this dry cotton candy kind of thing.
Well, coconut has natural, like, also coconut water has natural electrolytes in it. So that's why a lot of people recommend drinking coconut water when you're hungover or when you've been throwing up a lot.
It does have a lot of sugar, though.
Yeah.
I feel like it does have a lot of natural sugars. The ones that
we drink normally that come in that, like, carton box or whatever, those usually have added sugar, I think.
Yeah. Yeah.
Those are not, like.
For sure.
Yeah, but you can at some natural food grocery stores and a lot of, like, Thai markets or Asian markets, you can buy, like, young coconuts that they've already peeled the outer hard shell of it and then have puncture, you know, like, it's basically like a thing where they provide you with a little thing where you can puncture a hole in it so you can drink the fresh coconut.
Yeah. I've had a few of those fresh coconuts on our travels.
This guy wouldn't stop fucking drinking coconuts. He loved it. He just kept ordering coconuts.
Well, I was dehydrated as all hell, bro. You know how much liquid I let out in Vietnam?
Me too,
just
man.
Just sweating through my pores, just drenched. It was so
and
hot.
The funny thing about that whole trip was that you insisted on carrying a backpack with you everywhere. I was like, damn, dude.
Yeah, I did.
I remember one of the pictures that he sent me from when you guys were in Vietnam. Like, he looked like such a sweaty, drunk mess.
Oh, yeah. Oh, man. I know that I basically was... And I was getting drunk there, too.
We were getting
drunk. So I was getting drunk, but I was already sweaty before I started drinking.
You were on vacation. What? You weren't getting drunk.
I made so many friends, you know, in Vietnam, just talking to weird people. I met friends.
Yeah, you went out.
With, like, random people, dude.
That was great.
It was awesome. That's what you got to do when you travel, dude.
That's what you got to do.
You got to go with me. You got sick, though. That was a bummer, dude. Greg got sick, man.
That sucked.
But you know what's cool, dude, is you're stronger now because of it, dude. You're not
going to
get sick next time.
I hope so. I really hope so.
You know, you went to a goddamn other side of the world, bro.
Dude, I was so sick. It was crazy. That was a brutal flu.
That was bird flu, bro. You just had bird flu.
I felt like I had some sort of, like, end of the world apocalypse.
And
like,
now you're fine.
Man-killing flu.
Now you're fine, dude. That's what the human body does, man. It fights off shit.
Well, I mean, I don't know if it's a human body, because I took a shitload of drugs, dude.
Yeah, that's true.
I went...
The human body and antibiotics.
Shitload of drugs. I was loaded up, dude. There was like 8 pills in the morning, 8 pills in the afternoon, and 8 pills at night.
What was crazy is I went to go buy those pills,
it
was like $2. This shit was so cheap, I'll just
take it all.
She handed me so many drugs, and I'm like, oh no, how much is this going to cost? She was like, oh, $5. You're like, what? Oh my God.
I know, dude. Imagine if we needed like that kind of sickness and antibiotics. That would have been thousands of dollars, man. I would have had to go to a doctor.
Yeah.
I would have had to like get all kinds of prescriptions. Oh, yeah. Like it would have been fucking possibly a hospital visit.
The other thing too, though, is I have no idea what she gave you.
I really have no idea what she gave me. But now I've got a few leftovers that I smuggled back in.
Oh, and shit. Like, Greg's getting arrested. Trump's coming for your pills, bro.
Come for me. I'll swallow them. Good luck proving it, man. Good luck proving it. That's right.
Yeah, man. It was just wild. It was wild.
It was crazy.
So, anyway, Liz, I think...
yeah, it's been good.
We got to wrap it up here. We're way over the time.
There's no time. Time is an illusion, bro.
Well, there's no consequences.
Yeah, so what's the problem? We're good.
Are we wrapping it, or do you want to keep
going?
Let's wrap it.
No, let's wrap it. But, you know, it's no ending until we say there's an ending.
What do you want to do, Greg? Do you want to talk about my mom's book on the food episode?
I do want to talk about your mom's book. Oh, fuck. Where are we at right now?
I only have a couple things I want to talk about.
Let's talk about it.
Let's talk about it.
Yeah. So your mom is...
My mom's Elaine Kozrova, and she wrote a book called Butter, A Rich History. And it's a fascinating book. And I'm not, you know, obviously she's my mom, and I'm like really proud of her. Shout out, love you, mom.
Yeah, did she have? Can you get it on Amazon?
You can buy it on Amazon. Yeah. Yep, it gets shipped to your house.
Does she have a website or anything?
I'll find out. Yeah, I don't know.
Right
now she's just kind of trying different things out.
Her young son should make her one.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Actually, what she's trying to do right now is she's trying to make a company that creates tissue box holders. And you get them shipped to your house. Because there's no one doing that.
Wait, I've had tissue box holders. What do you mean?
Was there one company that you go to for that?
Oh, no.
Yeah.
It was like...
Her company like hires immigrants that came here legally. That have nothing to do, but have like are skilled labor for like creating things, and so they make these beautiful wooden tissue boxes.
She's got a sweatshop.
Yeah, got a sweatshop. Yeah. A legal one. Yeah, a legal one. Yeah,
a legal.
No,
sweatshop.
A lot of these people don't speak English. They don't have any. They're refugees.
Yeah,
refugees, not immigrants. Refugees. Yeah, so they come to America. In upstate New York, there's a bunch of them, and she was helping.
But they're
these
getting
people.
Paid, right?
Yeah, they get paid. Oh. They make money. Great. Yeah, that's the point of it. It's like they can have a job and do something. And...
Slavery's bad.
Yeah, slavery's terrible.
Yeah.
I agree. Anyway, that's irrelevant. She wrote a book called Butter, A Rich History, and I wanted to talk about a couple things I found really interesting in it. One of them was this thing called bog butter.
What's that?
Have you heard of bog butter?
No, what is that?
So they found in, like Wales and Scotland, Ireland, or, you know, wherever there are these peat bogs, right? Mm-hmm. The fine butter that was buried like 3,000, 5,000 years ago. And it's in these urns. And it's been capped off with a lid. Because the bog has all this acidity, the butter never goes bad.
Oh.
It was like an old refrigerator.
Oh.
And the conditions of these bogs, you could bury stuff. They found people mummified by the bogs.
What?
Huh.
Yeah. Ancient people have been mummified. But so
what is the acidity from, though? Like,
the plants, the life, I guess, in the bog. I'm not entirely sure. It's just that the conditions. And people lived in these bogs. They're not, like, dangerous to live in. But, you know, they found out because butter used to be a commodity that you would pay rent in.
Ooh.
Think about it. If you had a farm and you made butter, that was something you would give to your landowner to pay the rent.
Yeah.
Okay. So landowners would bury this shit because they're getting all this butter. What do you do with it if you can't eat it? You got to preserve it, right?
Yeah.
So you could bury it in these bogs and they would just never go bad.
That's dope, dude. I watched this Netflix documentary called Cooked where they were talking about how they would... Like there's still people doing this where there's like one bread maker like in Afghanistan or whatever. I can't remember what country he's from, but he's like the one bread maker and he makes the bread because he has the like tools to do it.
Yeah.
And like, but he doesn't have the resources to do it. So people come to him and he like barters with them like, okay, like I'll do this for everybody. I make these like loaves every day, but you bring me your grain and I'll make the bread. People bring him grain and they say, okay, you can have this much grain for yourself if I can get like five loaves or whatever, you know. So like
it's a contract.
It's a barter system. People. Yeah, but like that's how they're paying for things these countries.
Honestly,
and it's like,
you know what's crazy, dude, is like that is where we used to be.
Society. And we're still, that's what I'm saying, is that's still going on though. Like we are the weird generation of people who's like come together to like trade this thing that we've all decided means something.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think that's what the whole, I wasn't talking about cryptocurrencies, dude, but all that whole movement of like contracts between people online, you know, that is kind of a recursion back to what we used to do in terms of bartering, right?
Yeah.
It's like, but how do you do that online? You know, like, how do you create these contracts between people where I have this thing and you have this thing?
Yeah.
And we want to trade, you know? People are trying to figure that out right now. But
well, that's cool because I don't want to you know, propose that we're all communists, you know, now. But yeah. I like the idea of...
I don't think we are.
No, I don't think we are, but I mean, this is
I'm capitalist as fuck.
I know, I know.
I just bought a VR headset, motherfucker. Woo! Capitalism.
But I just was going to say, like, I think, like, this idea that you're trading a service for, you know, potentially another service or another, you know, thing that you need or want.
Well, think about
is like requires people to be skilled at something.
Yeah.
Rather than being a monotonous nobody who
doesn't do shit,
makes, you know, fish faces on Instagram photos and doesn't do shit and gets butt implants, and that's what makes them famous, is like frustrating. You know what I mean? Because like, we could do more, and people are doing it, which is great.
What's interesting is like a Kickstarter. You know, imagine a Kickstarter where we're all on Kickstarter.
Yeah.
And I'm Kickstartering you, and you're Kickstartering me, so we get each other's thing.
Yeah, exactly. You know? That's dope.
That would be cool.
That would be dope. Yeah. I like that idea. That's a cool idea. You know?
Well, anyway,
it's a communal way of like, you know, creating
an economy. Yeah, we used to barter butter, and now if you want to make butter, you can sell it online.
Yeah.
But no, the other thing I wanted to talk about that I thought was interesting, you know, in terms of this is you talk about selling it online. They used to create butter molds, right? That was like one of the earliest forms of branding, right? So if you made butter, they would have these molds, and when you went to the marketplace, essentially, these molds would shape your butter in different ways, and people would buy these shapes and know that it came from.
So how did we decide on the brick or whatever?
You know, we started wrapping it up in packaging, and it was cheaper to do that than to try to mold it, you
into
know?
Like a sphere.
Into a cool, yeah, you could do spherical butter, right? This is what I was saying. It's done a cool butter shape, although the brick works.
I've seen this documentary about, like, there was some sort of show or documentary called, I think it was called Butter, about, people creating butter sculptures.
Yeah, my mom talks about this in her book. There are actually, because in, I believe
I
some...
I love that movie, by the way.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was a movie,
so
then.
So funny.
No, she talks about it in her book, but in some religions, they do butter sculptures. And it's not actually butter. What's crazy is they mix butter with, like, other... I think it was, like, paraffin or... With other things, and create a wax. And that's how they sculpt the butter, and that's how it stays together.
That's what I was wondering, is like, how do you...
Because they're
be
in
such
hot
a,
places.
Yeah, I was like,
and
how the
like,
fuck do you do this in a freezer? What are you doing?
No, they like create a new butter... can't eat them. They're not edible.
Okay.
You know? But they do probably, you know, over time get messed up and go away.
I bet vegans hate that shit.
Oh, they're just... Well, you know, the cows that butter came from probably weren't raised on a giant factory farm. You know, you're in a Tibetan culture. They have their own yaks or something on a mountainside. How are you going to get angry about that?
No, I'm talking about the butter sculptors.
Oh, yeah.
The people using butter and then mixing it with some shit that makes it inedible is like...
But I'm saying the cow that it came from didn't lead a bad life. So if they get angry about it, what are they angry
How do you
about?
Know that?
Because I'm saying these are like ancient cultures, dude.
That are sculpting butter?
No, but not like when it's...
The tradition.
I think he's talking about like...
I'm talking
about like
the
butter
competition.
The
competition.
Oh, the competition
yeah.
where they sculpt butter? Yeah, that's fucked up.
Yeah. Like, because it's all just going to waste if you're that uses...
No, there was like religious reasons, but yeah, now people just have butter competitions?
Yeah.
Oh,
that's what I was talking about in the movie.
What a waste of butter, dude.
You didn't, that's what this movie was like. So you're talking about like an ancient cultural thing.
Yes,
and this has become this...
In my
like,
mom's book, she goes over like the ancient kind of uses.
Because this is now
butter
become...
Butter sculpting. Yeah.
Yeah, this
but you're
is
saying there's modern competitions.
Oh, there's this has become pageantry, dude.
Yeah,
that's what it is. It's like a total pageantry of like
so
you know,
weird,
your butt instead of doing a sand sculpture like at the beach competition.
Yeah, it's a butter
there's
sculpture.
A butter sculpture competition. Yeah.
One of the other things I really kind of thought was fascinating was how like during medieval times they were fasting half the year, dude.
What?
They would fast every other day. Almost, and basically half the year they were fasting.
Wow.
And they put these crazy restrictions on their diets. They were like not into like anything that made you feel good. So butter became like banned in some places.
Why?
They would eat oil instead.
Oh.
Yeah, they had oil instead of butter. Well, no, we do it with olive oil.
Yeah, but I'm just imagining. But there's areas of the world. I'm just imagining them just drinking that. Like, I couldn't drink that shit.
Well, do you drink butter? What are you talking about?
No.
Why would they be drinking the
oil? But I also don't skip a meal, like, eating every other day.
You're saying they're so hungry, they're just, like, ripping down oil. Yeah, no, I don't know. I can't speak to the
amount. Why would they do that, though? I'm saying, like, if they make it unpleasurable, you know,
Because in Christianity, they was, like, there's a lot of this like self-loathing.
So how the fuck were they eating the oil then?
No, every other day they would eat, and they would eat oil and
I know, but how were they eating the oil? You know what I mean?
Oh,
were
I
they
don't know
just
what their
drinking
ancient recipes
it or
were. No, they would use it instead of butter, right? So if
so
you
they
put
would
butter
put
around, in something, you would use oil.
But that still makes it taste good. That's what I'm saying. It's like
not as good as butter. Butter was too like.
It's too flavorful.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. So they're not complete masochists.
No, but they were
like.
But what happened was there's areas that didn't have olive oil, and they couldn't make butter because it was like banned.
Okay.
And they had to basically like have a. There was like a whole issue where these nations had to be like, listen, can you please let us make butter? I know we're all Christians and all this stuff.
Yeah.
Please let us make butter. Like we are literally, we need some kind of thing. We need something.
Yeah.
And your oil sucks. Apparently all the oil that was getting shipped around was just, like, not good, you know? Like, they would keep the good shit for themselves and just ship shitty oil to other countries. So, I don't know. I thought that was kind of interesting.
Yeah, that's cool.
And they also used to use butter, dogs to churn butter.
Oh, shit. I should use my dog for that.
Yeah. So if you have a dog, you just, you just have him churn the butter.
Build a... treadmill for your dog.
I'm not really sure. Does that thing of putting like a carrot in front of a donkey, does that work and it just walks on a treadmill forever?
It works when I do it with
I've
Charlie with a treat.
Yeah, he just keeps walking towards it.
Well, if I, you know how he is with walking, he fucking hates walking. So, but if I have like a whimsy with me and I just like, come on, buddy, I got your whimsy. He'll just keep jumping at it like a little.
Forever. till the end of time.
Well, I've never tried to go till the end of time, but.
Well, you are. The experiment is currently underway. So, yeah, but it's a great book. It's honestly like my mom, I'm really proud of how well written it is. And, you know, it's just nice to read, you know? Fun, cool stuff going on.
Super cool.
And check it out.
Dude, that's dope.
Yeah, that's been Dude, That's Dope. Thanks you guys for joining us. Thank you, Liz.
Yeah, thanks
for being
on
the show. How was it? How do you feel?
That was definitely really fun. I'm really glad that you guys enjoyed the food that I made. And like I said, I really hope that listeners at least go and check out my blog.
Yeah, check out freefoodie510.
Yeah.
.com.
And I just really hope that you guys at least check it out, just so you can at least get a better concept of the food that you're making for yourself, and you can be more inspired to try something different.
Yeah.
You know, go and buy a cookbook or order a cookbook on Amazon, or, you know, just look up a recipe online, like on my blog, whether or not it's on my blog or somebody else's blog.
Keep cooking, people.
Try something new, because food is awesome.
Yeah, food is awesome, I gotta say, it's awesome to have you here. Thank you so much.
Yeah.
You guys have a lovely night.
All right.
This is Alex and Greg signing off.
And everybody be excellent to each other.
Yeah, everybody be excellent. Yeah. All right, Chozo.